This is the Preparedness Radio Network, preparing you for natural and man-made disasters, helpful tips on gardening and homesteading. Be prepared, and remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.
I'm Dr. Prepper, and I'm here today to tell you about the Wonder Mill. Their patented grain mills create the most luxurious and quality flours from any hard grains or beans. They contract with the world's best-suited factories to manufacture the Wonder Mill to the highest specifications in the industry that they plan and design right up there in Pocatello, Idaho. They are the only American company with both electric and hand-operated models. I like them so much, I bought both, and you should too. I use the electric model for the finest flour, and I use the hand-operated model for making my grits and creamy wheat for breakfast, and I can have it fresh every day. With the Wonder Mill's lifetime warranty and the fact that these are simply the world's fastest, quietest, cleanest operating grain mills, it's no wonder that most preparedness and kitchen professionals prefer the Wonder Mill over all the other grain mills on the market. I love both mine. I know you'll love yours, too. Go to thewondermill.com. That's thewondermill.com. And Wonder Mill Grain Grinders. Get yours today. Tell them that Dr. Prepper sent you, will you?
Discover the taste of the sun. Thousands of preppers have acquired a sun oven to have on hand in the event of an emergency and have been pleasantly surprised by the improved taste of sun-cooked foods. Sun ovens are a preparedness item you can start using today. A sun oven will pay for itself by reducing your utility bills and by keeping your house cooler in the summer. Food can be baked, boiled, or steamed at temperatures of 360 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit with the power of the sun. Sun ovens are often confused with homemade solar cookers, but they get considerably hotter, cook food faster, and hold temperatures longer. Sun ovens fold up in seconds, carry like a suitcase, and have many innovative features which make them the ultimate solar appliance. For the past 25 years, sun ovens have been proudly made in the U.S. They are durable and have a long life and come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. For a discount coupon, email preppers at sunoven.com. That's preppers at sunoven.com. It's time for Preparedness Solutions. Bubba's Bookshelf is on the air. Bubba's Bookshelf is a weekly book discussion show, Fridays at 8 p.m. Central Time, that attempts to wade through the massive amount of information published in categories from back to basics to the zombie apocalypse. Each week, your host, Bubba Da Vinci, with the help of authors, experts, and the audience, will help you fill your library with knowledge and not just books. And now, pull up a chair, crack open a book with your friend, Bubba.
Hey, 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 this is Bubba Da Vinci with Bubba's Bookshelf. I guess our show producer, Steve, decided that he wanted to do another show this morning, so we started a different intro, but that's okay. Good morning, Steve. I'm pretty excited. It's been about 3 weeks since we've had a Bubba's Bookshelf. We are now on Saturday mornings, the first hour right before Backwoods Home Magazine Self-Reliance Exposed. And, we're gonna start off right. This morning we have Marjorie Wildcraft. She's going to be on. And, you know, Marjorie is the creator of Grow Your Own Groceries. And it's a fantastic DVD. I usually do books, but we're expanding it to do books and DVDs and anything that you can pick up that will help your background content on getting prepared. And she sent me an email the other day and said, you know, I'd really like to talk about what's going on with this drought. And we started talking about how it affects everything, and I said, you know, I think it's a great idea. And then she came up with the title, you know, Dead Corn, How It Will Affect You. And so here in a few minutes, we're going to have Marjorie on, and we're going to talk about something that's very, very important, which is, you know, what happens when you have a 17% decrease I'm sorry, 17-year low in your bushel yield per acre on corn, and that's horrible. Additionally, I'm trying something new today. My oldest daughter has been helping me with, they're interested in becoming self-reliant, and my oldest daughter said that she wanted to help me start working on the website stuff and the Facebook pages, and that's been going great. And then my middle daughter said, hey, I want to help you on the radio. So my middle daughter, who you guys often see on Facebook, Gabby, is going to start helping me on a weekly basis, and she's going to be my little producer slash assistant here in the office. I'm teaching her how to work the board and the Facebook, and we're going to start teaching her how to do monitor the chat. So say hi, Gabrielle.
Hi.
So this is a short episode, so I want to get straight to Marjorie get going on this fantastic topic. So, Marjorie, are you on? Marjorie?
Oh, good morning. Am I on?
You're on. Good morning, Marjorie.
Oh.
How are you?
Oh, good. Yay, thanks for having me back.
Oh, wonderful. We're very excited. I'm very excited with this topic. So,
me too.
I was just explaining to everybody that you had given me you shot me an email last week and said, one of the things you'd like to cover with everybody is, we're in a drought now. This week they reported that the drought has gone from 62% of the country to 61.77% of the country, which, it really isn't that much of a decline, but I guess at least it is a decline, and that at this point, we're at about a 17-year low on bushels per acre on corn and about a 12-year low on soybean production.
Yeah,
And your concern and you came up with this fantastic title. It's dead corn, how will it affect you? And you kind of wanted to talk us through some of the things that most people probably aren't thinking about.
We don't anymore, do we? I mean, the United States, 95-97% of our population used to be involved in agriculture, a little more than a century ago, and now it's, less than 1%, 2%, or 3%. So we just don't think about it because food is just always there and abundant and available, and it hasn't been a concern. But those things are changing. This drought this year is, it's a big flag for those people that are aware and awakening and wanting to step more into self-reliance and look at how things are connected and their part in it. And so it's an important conversation to have. Fortunately, we're not really in any dire danger right now here in the United States, but there are going to be a lot bigger consequences internationally. And we might as well get started right in there. Yeah, I know, I've watched the USDA, and the USDA is like the federal government or the White House or something. When they say something, they move markets. So they tend to be very conservative. And if I were in that position, I would tend to be very conservative too. So they're saying that, about 30% of the corn crop from what they had originally projected way back, in April or May, is not going to make. But we're going, okay, so you're telling us 30%, but we're saying that 60-65% of the corn has already been deemed to be poor or very poor condition. So we know that it's actually going to be a lot worse. But they want to put that news out there incrementally downward just because it would be a lot of chaos to the markets, I think. The good news is there's actually a lot of corn. I want to say right from the outset, by the way, that I don't believe that the corn they're growing is actually food.
Well, I would agree with it.
Yeah, that's like 85% or 90%. Some ungodly amount of that corn is GMO corn, and it's, grown on these huge, huge, we all know the mega farms, never touched by human hands, never had, the plants don't know the love, that the connection and the bond that you get when you're growing your own food. Those plants it's a process, and that food, when you eat it, it's a process, and then you become a part of that process. You don't want to be involved in that. But the fact is, most of our population is dependent on that food source, so we need to talk about it. What the deal is we grow a huge amount of this corn, and corn by far is the largest product that the United States grows. Soybeans are next, and wheat's after that, and we actually do grow a substantial amount of rice too. But corn is our big deal. And I also want to dispel a myth. You know, I know when I was growing up, everybody's heard, right, the United States is the breadbasket of America, right? We feed everybody, right? And I used to think, oh, you know, we're producing two times or three times or four times the amount of food that we need, and that's why India has a billion people, right? Because we're feeding them.
Right.
And at one point, that may have been true. I think sometime in the 50s or 60s, or certainly after World War II, we may have been providing a lot more to the world than we are now. The reality is, corn is the big thing that we grow. We're only exporting about 10 to 15% of the corn that we grow. So we're not, you know, while we are the largest exporter of grain in the world, it's not like we got this huge excess, you know. It is a lot, but it's not like, oh, it's not like twice as much we need or something like that. So we're not exporting a huge amount. What we're doing, and the whole wild card in this conversation, is ethanol. Now, I don't know how ethanol gets started, and I've been asking people on my list if they know, and hopefully somebody listening to the show will know who's behind ethanol. Let us talk about one of the biggest, most colossal, stupid things to do. You know, let's import a bunch of fossil fuel to grow corn that is going to make fuel that we end up losing energy in the whole process, right?
Right.
But last year, 40% of the corn we grew went into making ethanol. So there's a huge amount of corn that we grow. There's plenty and plenty, plenty of corn out there. The real question is, and, you know, even if we didn't have ethanol, there would still be plenty of corn, right? So the real question is what's going to happen to ethanol? And that's the big wild card in this conversation. And one of the reasons why I'm trying to find out who is behind ethanol is, first of all, that certainly wasn't a grassroots kind of public, like, wow, we think this is a good idea. Hey, tell your congressman, let's get ethanol going. I mean, this was not like people wanted this. This was clearly some big, powerful, some entity that had a lot of influence was able to get the ethanol mandate and that whole ethanol thing going. And I guarantee you there's a huge amount of money involved in it. And so the real question now is, there's going to be so much pressure. I was talking to you earlier before the show to get this ethanol mandate, to get rid of that, because feed prices are going. I mean, corn has gone up. What? How much have you been? Look, I didn't check Friday's numbers, but corn is pretty close to have doubled in the last couple of months. I mean, it's maybe 60 or 70% increase. That's a huge amount to anybody who's having to feed animals. So the price of meat is going to start rising pretty dramatically. And that's because we're using this corn to make ethanol. Now, if we get rid of the ethanol mandate and then suddenly all that corn gets freed up for feed and stuff, well, you know, we're really not going to have any impact on prices, really. But that's the question, is who's behind ethanol, and how long will it take to get that particular thing undone, the ethanol
right.
thing?
Well, and you know, I couldn't tell you who's behind the ethanol. I do know that there's a lot of subsidies in a lot of states where your gas prices for ethanol-based fuels are less expensive. And you know, I've been told, although I can't confirm it, that, you know, those subsidies are kept to keep the people in those states and those areas pro-ethanol. So, like, here in Iowa, I can get regular unleaded gas, we'll just say like $3.50, but if I get the higher octane premium gas that has more ethanol in it, it's ethanol based, I actually get it for like 8 cents to 10 cents cheaper. So you're getting a higher grade of gas for cheaper than you get for standard.
And the reason for that. How long are they going to be able to do that now that the price of corn has gotten so much higher, though?
Well, and your fuel prices, as everything else goes up, they just, you know, they keep it below that, but they keep the question is how deep are the pockets on these subsidies?
Yeah.
You know, and you kind of have to figure out, like you said, who's behind the ethanol and why they're backing it, in order to kind of figure that out. I mean, they could always keep it lower as long as they're meeting whatever their agenda is.
Well,
but
if the pockets are the U.S. government, they're pretty deep, right? Look at, they're already talking about QE3 again, you know, like, let's spend some more money. Gosh. You know, there is absolutely no way we're going to avoid, you know, hyperinflation in this country. I don't know when it's going to come, but this is the pattern that has played itself over and over again historically. But to go back to the corn, I don't know if you remember in 2008 when grain prices got really, really high. And here in the United States, a lot of our cost of food has to do with packaging and processing and transportation. It's not necessarily the raw food itself. So if the price of corn doubles, it doesn't really affect your grocery bill that much other than the meat. We'll get to the meat. We'll get back to the meat in a little bit. Even though, 75% of the food products in the grocery store contain some corn in them? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's about that.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, but it's a huge amount.
But in other countries in the world where, you know, people are eating, first of all, they're eating the food a lot more in its native, you know, they're eating directly grains just the way they come. They're not eating processed foods. They're eating foods more in their bulk or natural state. And they're spending 30 to 50 or maybe 70% of their income on food. Well, the price of corn from America, you know, going up 60% or doubling is going to have a huge impact on them. And where I'm going with this is it actually shocked me when I first had this revelation, and I was reading, you know how you can flip around on the web and you go all over the place, and I happened to stumble across, believe it or not, MIT has a website up where they put all sorts of articles. And there was a research article published on the cause of riots and the price of food. And these guys, this is from the Complex Systems Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they, Marco Laghi and his group and associates, and they were looking at riots, and they were trying to find, and they're from the Complex Systems Institute, so they were looking for all these complex relationships between rioting and what is the cause of riots. And they were shocked to find it came down to one single thing, and that is the price of food. And it's not necessarily that people riot about food, but it's just that when the price of food gets so high, that's what it takes to get the average person in the street agitated enough to start looking at civil unrest or violence or revolution. And sure enough, you know, and so Laghi and his associates, they put together this model, and they looked at the price of food, and then they looked at, you know, the amount of riots and rioting going on around the world. And sure enough, they have a model that can pretty accurately predict when rioting will break out. And they were looking at the model, and this was back in, I think, 2009. It was just before Tunisia broke out with Mohammed. And they said, hey, we know in the Middle East there's going to be a lot of turbulence over there really soon. We know there's going to be rioting breaking out. And they tried to send a letter to the U.S. government. Now, I don't know who do you send a letter to in the U.S. government. And apparently they didn't know either, and nothing ever happened. But sure enough, right after their model predicted was when the whole Arab Spring started to unfold. And they could say, look, we know it's clearly correlated to the price of food. And if you remember, there was some big spikes in food prices at that time. Now,
right.
Since then, we've had some good years, and we've had more grain coming in, and the price has gone down again. But and of course, you know, that same correlation, once I started, I was like, oh, wow, that makes sense. You know, because we've all been watching, right? Most of us are patriots, and we've been seeing just the egregious behavior of the absolute corruption of our government, the incredible things that they're doing, that really, you know, tyrannical behavior. And I'm like, why aren't people why isn't there more of a reaction from the public from this? This is the question I've had for more than a decade of watching this. Why aren't people, you know, going crazy over this? And it really comes down to the price of food.
Right.
Because everybody's got a full belly, you know.
Yeah, well, and you know, even the United Nations, so just kind of give you an update. So corn futures traded and closed yesterday 60% higher than they have in the previous year. It's at $8 a bushel, and soy has jumped up 24%, so 60 and 24%. And the United Nations has jumped in now and has asked for a suspension or a lower mandate for the biofuels. So in 2007, there was a law passed that 13.2 billion gallons of biofuel, ethanol, had to be produced a year to offset oil prices. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's where I'm going, is that because of the connectedness of all of us on the planet and the fact that the U.S. still does provide a lot of grain internationally, and we do affect the price of food for a lot of the rest of the planet, there's not only is there going to be your local ranchers and you know, chicken farmers and pig farmers saying, hey, we can't afford to feed anymore, but there's going to be international pressure, and the U.N. is stepping that up. The UN also is very clearly aware of this. You'll watch the UN will start making announcements about, you know, we're expecting more violence around the globe, we're expecting more civil unrest because the prices of food are going up. Henry Kissinger, you know, he was famously quoted of saying, you know, control the food and you control the people. The Romans, this was known back in the Roman times, they said give people bread and give them games and they'll never revolt. So this correlation between the price of food and, you know, the amount of upset. So I've often thought, well, you know, as I said, I'm watching what's going on in the world, and I've always wondered why, you know, when we did these illegal things, or really the government does these egregious things, I mean, why aren't people up in arms about this? And I've decided, you know, the United States, when you want to know when the revolution is going to start here in the United States, just watch the food prices in the grocery store. That's when you'll know it's going to really start to happen here. So the concern is that, yes, so there's going to be international pressure, not only from the UN, but from all these other countries that are depending on these food supplies, the cheaper food from America that is not cheap anymore. And there, you know, quite frankly, there's a lot of countries out there, a lot of really poor people and that are angry at America in the first place. And if they're hungry and angry at America, we're really potentially inciting, you know, other types of consequences of the upset against the United States. For it is really egregious to be growing all this corn just to turning it into fuel. That is a hugely egregious waste of resources for the entire planet, and needs to be remedied. The question is, as we watch this now, in the interim, so there's a lot of reports out there. People are saying, well, you know, there's going to be a glut of meat on the market because already, you know who, Larry Pope, one of the executives of Smithfield Foods, like the largest pork producer in the world, and he was quoted as saying, look, you know, meat may very well become too expensive to eat. And he said, you know, beef, of course, is going to be get really expensive, and pork and chicken are not that far behind. And he was saying at least double-digit increases in the price of meat going forward, just based on what we already know with the price of corn. And the corn could certainly go further up because USDA, of course, in September is going to lower their estimates again. But and so there are a lot of people are saying, well, there's going to be a glut of meat on the market. But I would say I don't think so because, you know, Texas and Oklahoma has been in a severe drought for the last 4 years. And certainly with beef, I know we used to have a herd of miniature cattle. And we sold our, you know, we didn't have a lot. We had, you know, six or eight of them. And we sold them a couple of years ago because we could not afford to feed. It just got too expensive. You couldn't buy a bale of hay in Texas. And it's getting, you know, we got a little bit of rains this winter, but it's still hard to find feed. And ranchers, for the last 4 years have been selling off their herds. It's not like all of a sudden we're going to sell our herds. The herds are really, really low.
Well, and yeah, because of the since I just came from Texas, we had it was a 5-year drought that we had a minor relief on. And what people don't realize is they're globally for this at least the next 2 years, the meat prices were going to be high for the simple reason that all the ranchers in the lower half of the United States, because they had to get rid of their cattle because of lack of grass and the expense of keeping them, now have to basically rebuild their stock, and that's not something you can do over a very short period of time to build it back up. We're seeing cattle prices up here in the north going for astronomical prices because people from the lower states are having to buy to replenish those herds. And so it's a cycle.
It is. And beef has a long, as you were saying, it's a long time. You know, it takes 9 months to gestate the calf and the cow. And then to get that calf up to a marketable weight is, you know, it depends on the breed and timing. But, yes, at least another 2 years in there. So we're talking long, long. But even with everybody selling off their herds in the last years, you know, the price of beef rose 9% last year, even with ranchers selling off their herds. So it's, you know, I just don't see a meat glut happening. Maybe in pork and chicken. And chicken can, of course, respond a lot more quickly to changes in grain prices just because, you know, they grow them out in about 12 weeks, right? So it's not it's not as long of a lead time item.
So there's a conspiracy theory that was thrown out. After I posted your thing, I got a couple of emails, and I just want to get your thoughts on this. One of the people wrote to me and said that they believe that although there's a drought and that they believe that the direct pricing is directly related to the drought, that they believe that all this high-end futures trading on this product is these large GMO companies who can take advantage of this because their GMO products are they have a lot more drought-resistant strains, and therefore their products will be more likely to get into the market, feeding our cattle and everything else. Because they pointed out that in times like this, the small farmer / home self-reliance person can no longer afford to keep their few cattle, few goats, and chickens, and it becomes less expensive to buy the GMO-created product that is in the stores. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's an interesting angle. That's an interesting angle. I think it's a bigger play. I think there's some upset going on with the people with ethanol, and that to some extent this whole thing is, well, first of all, the drought's occurring. There's other conspiracy theories that say that they have weather modification, the HARP tools and stuff like that. And I don't know those exist or not, but I'm like, if they exist, why are we having this drought?
You know? Right.
It's real hard to say. In all the food systems that I develop, and self-reliance, I know a lot of people think, oh, self-reliance, I'm going to get some chickens and some goats. Part of that self-reliance is growing the feed for the animals yourself. If you're a small homesteader and you've got some livestock, if you're dependent on the feed store to feed them, and we all are to some extent. I mean, it certainly is a lot easier when you're getting started to buy feed. And I don't want to discourage anybody, but you know, being dependent on the feed store is the same as being dependent on the grocery store, and that's a whole other reason for saying when I want self-reliance, I want to be able to grow the food for them. And for in my systems, for example, I'll give you another myth of the small homesteaders. A lot of people, it's funny how many people believe this. They say, oh, you know, we're going to go back to the land and we're going to eat chicken. You know, we'll have a chicken once a week. And I'm like, no, I don't think you will. If you're going to have a chicken once a week, that's, you know, 52 birds a year. That means you're going to have a pretty big flock. You're going to have a flock of about 40 or 60 birds because, you know, they got to get reproducing and then getting to maturity, and there's, you know, that whole cycle going, and you always got to have a pretty good sized flock if you're going to be eating from it all the time. If you're going to be feeding 40 to 60 chickens a year, you're going to be growing a whole lot of grain or other food support. You're going to actually basically be having to buy their grain, and that there, when you're doing that, then you're not self-reliant. That's one of the reasons I'm really big on other livestock, such as rabbits, which are herbivores, which is a much, much easier diet for a homesteader or somebody interested in self-reliance like you or I to be able to come up with a diet for rabbits. I mean, I could, right now I feed my diets half the feed I buy it, but I could be at 100% of feed for them, you know, at any time I choose. I'm choosing not to do it now just for the convenience. But it's a whole lot easier for me to come up with the feed for the rabbits than it is for me to come up with the feed for the chickens.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Marjorie, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go ahead and continue on with this conversation, okay?
Okay, great.
All right, go ahead. And we're going to be back after two commercials, guys. We'll see you in a few.
You're listening to the Preparedness Radio Network. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disaster situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just a conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Hey, meat eaters, the freeze-dried guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dried guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The freeze-dried guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the Freeze Dry Guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
Thanks for listening to A Word from Our Sponsors. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Bubba's Bookshelf. We're talking live with Marjorie Wildcraft, and we're discussing the drought and how the drought with corn will affect you. So thanks for waiting, Marjorie. Welcome back.
Oh, my pleasure. Going back to our last question, I have to say I love conspiracy theories. Unfortunately, it's really hard to go one way or the other with them, but I love to look at the different possibilities for what might be.
No, I do too. And when people actually take the time to email or write and say, well, these are my thoughts, I like to bring them up and give it a little bit of play in the conversation, because that's what it's all about is, you know, you take this information and sometimes you go, well, I hadn't thought of it from that angle, and you pull something out of it that's useful. So you might as well go ahead and at least explore them a little bit.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's go back to what you were saying. So, you know, you were saying that that for you, it works better to, you know, you grow a lot of your own food that you feed to your rabbits. And it was a good point. I really hadn't thought about that with the chickens. That, because you're right, the go-to animal for anybody that gets into this field and trying to become self-reliant is always chickens. Everybody automatically, there is such a boom in chicken sales this last year because everybody wants to have chickens for the eggs.
And they're great animals, and they are great animals for the eggs. They really are. They're just a fantastic component to your whole bevy of what you want to have going on. It's just you're not going to be eating a lot of chicken meat if you're working towards a truly self-reliant system. Here's one other angle. Yeah, one other angle that I've thought about using chickens for. Now, you know, chicken producing is got such thin margins on it. I mean, there's just not a lot of money in growing chickens or in growing eggs. There just isn't. And a part of that is the biggest expense with any chicken production facility is going to be the feed for the chickens, the chicken feed. According to Joel Salatin, you know, if you got them pasture raised and all that, you can get about 25% savings on your feeds, but you're still going to need to feed them about 75% of what they eat. Now, what I've often thought about doing with the chickens is doing that pasture raised thing like Joel does. You know, have some electric fencing and put them out in an area and let them graze, but then feed them the grain, and do that for a while to buy the feed as a way of increasing the fertility of my land. Knowing that this is not going to be something I'm going to do forever, but basically feeding the chickens and producing the meat as a way to have the chickens put the fertilizer out on the land and work the land for me. You know, I thought, well, that might be a good interim strategy. They get around there and they peck and they scratch and then they poop and, you know, they generally work the landscape. And you can, when managed properly, I've just seen amazing things that people have done with their land in terms of rejuvenating it, using livestock like that. But it's not a long-term solution. That's I'm going to get in this small business for a while to help build the fertility on my land strategy.
Right. Yeah, but because the chicken is the go-to animal initially for homesteaders, and like you said, at a minimum, 60 to 70% of the feed that you're going to feed them is probably going to be grains, and it's not going to be you're not going to be going out there and free-ranging them to get all their food. You know, I personally have seen a lot of people on Facebook and a lot of people talking about how this isn't an economical way to do things. And I wonder how, when you have not only the corn prices affecting them in the store and everything else, but how much this discourages them early on to not participate because they just don't think it's possible.
Well, I would like to go back and say that a small free-range flock, like if you've got a backyard and you just have two or three hens, and I'd always recommend having three at least because they are flocking animals. To have one chicken by itself is unbelievably cruel. They really are, they like companionship and they need that. And they need it for their own survival to have more eyes and ears looking around. But to have just three hens in the backyard, they'll lay, you know, you'll get, you know, one or two eggs a day out of them throughout most of the year. And you can just toss them your food scraps. Most likely they'll be able to peck around and find enough stuff in your backyard to do fairly well. So, you know, on a very small scale, I've got a flock of, I'm not sure how many they are. I think there's about 10 of them that just run around free range. And I only feed them, like right now in August when it's really dire straits and there's not much out there, and so I toss them some extra food. And then also in the winter in January, usually it's also another really tough time for the chickens, and I'll support them by feeding them then. But the rest of the time, there's usually more than enough insects and greens and different things that they're doing fine. But it's a very small flock. You know, I'm not trying to raise them for meat. I'm just raising for eggs.
Right.
I've been really encouraged by the backyard chicken thing. And, you know, I know a lot of people when they're getting into livestock, and myself too, you know, that it's easy to buy that grain and to get started. And by all means, that's the way to get started. You know, don't try right out in the beginning trying to feed your chickens everything. You know, get some grain and make it easier on yourself, because there's so many other things to learn, like, you know, making sure they've got water all the time and making sure that they're safe from predators and making sure they're warm or they're cool or all the other things that they need. So, you know, don't burden yourself with trying to figure out how to feed them right from the get-go, but definitely don't lose track of that as your ultimate goal.
Right. So let's go back into the what's happening with the corn and everything else. What do you, with the rain starting to come in a little bit, and they're saying that, although, again, from 62% to 61% of the country being in drought, when they made the announcement and said, oh, good news, yeah, we went down from 62% to 61.37.
Yes, that's, Yes, you've been watching the USDA, man. They really hype up. I remember one year seeing a headline of theirs. They said, the best yield we've had in more than 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess when things are serious, you grasp at whatever positive news there is.
Yeah.
So,
and bless their hearts, we don't want to create panic, right? So.
Right. But, I mean, do you think, what are your suggestions to people? I mean, I know, and this is horrible to say because, I mean, people automatically think about hoarding. You know, when I saw the prices jump up and feed from, you know, just the first 20%, you know, I went and got like 200 pounds of this and a couple hundred pounds of, you know, of that just because I was worried about what's happened. And we've gone up on our corn feed from, you know, $6 per hundred weight to like, I think it's like 20 some dollars per hundred weight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty significant.
Yeah. And it happened pretty quickly too, didn't it? I was pretty surprised by that. At the feed store, you see the markup goes up really quickly. Yeah.
I mean,
it doesn't seem to. Yeah.
Do you suggest that people go out and, I mean, do you think this is going to be something that continues? I mean, because winter's coming right around the corner, so our corn, the corn yield is the corn yield. We're pretty, there's some late planting stuff that's gone out, and so, again, if you look at the GMO product, you know, there's some soy, some late season soy that can get put in, but, you know, really, our season's pretty much over.
Our season is pretty much over, and even if we got rains in the Corn Belt now, that, you know, they're past the tasseling and pollination phase, it's not going to do any good. It's done. You know, the damage is done. Yeah, you know, that I think it would be prudent to I wouldn't call it hoarding. You know, I think it'd be prudent to pick up some extra feed if you're able to do that. I personally, a deep freezer and fill it with you know, meat. You know, I here in Texas we buy it by the cow, and I don't buy the I buy grass finished beef, but of course all the beef, the prices are so tied together, you can't help but, you know, It's they're all going to be affected, but yeah, it's, you know, it's time to pick up another cow and put it in the freezer, and, you know, get some other, you know, start stocking up on a few things. Now again, that could all be reversed if they suddenly lift the ethanol mandate, but you know, politically, I don't see that happening. I don't know. They may ease it somewhat, but I think that higher grain prices are here to stay for a while.
Well,
it's also time to Yeah.
Go ahead, Margaret.
But it really, this is also a you know, a big flag for all of those of us that do have livestock, of saying, hey, what can I do to start feeding my livestock more independently, so that, you know, it's a great wake up call, saying, hey, wow, this is going on, and feed has just, you know, gone up this much. You know, what can I do to start? So I'm looking at all kinds of perennials. In fact, at the Self-Reliance Expo in Dallas, that was one of the questions that came up with Jack Spirko and I when we had that meet and greet in the morning, and someone was saying, what can we do to feed our chickens without buying feed? There's lots of great things that you can plant to do that easily. You know, the lamb's quarters that'll sprout up, or mulberry trees or perennial trees. But I think the real great lesson from this, yes, yeah, so definitely storing up on some of it would be good, but also the real great lesson from this is, like, how can I shift my systems to be the next level of self-reliance? How can I shift my systems where I'm providing all the feed for my animals myself, or, you know, working in collaboration with a group or something, to where we're getting feed that's less dependent on the system?
Right. But, I mean, in the short term, so you mentioned going out there and getting your beef now in case the prices go up. I mean, the question is can how many people can really afford to do that anymore? Because, you know, beef prices jumping up. I mean, last time I looked, it was $4. They were saying the average price across America was like $4.72 a pound. I mean, that's significantly higher than a year ago. I mean, that's almost 50% higher.
Well, that's what I'm telling you. Even without this corn price thing going up, the price of beef has been going up, and that's with ranchers selling off their herds. So the price of beef is going to go much, 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 much higher. In fact, you know, buying a cow might not be a bad investment. buying a small milk cow for the family, and having her throw off a calf every now and then, you know, that course, that does take a bit of land, and that's certainly not in reach for everybody. Even with the land we have, I don't know if we could do it just because the droughts make it so unreliable to be able to feed even a single cow. It's been really tough here in Texas anyway. Yeah,
right. Well,
the other thing is to go in together, you know, and yeah, the price, if you think it's tough now paying $4.70 a pound for beef now, you know, what is it going to be 6 months or a year from now when it's $10 a pound or $15 a pound?
Let me ask you a question. What do you think, I just want to kind of get this out there before the end of the show. How much of this do you think is also directly affected by speculation? You know, I my personal thing is, you know, this isn't the first time that we've gone through a drought, and you know, and Texas goes through them in a cycle, and so does everybody else. But the key factor, and as you pointed out, kind of take a step back, you know, we probably don't export as much now or provide as much food for other countries now as we did in probably in the 50s and 60s. But what I believe is a major change now is this, that we've added the internet and we've added a lot of people who do speculation buys in the market. And I think those become huge drivers in really where the prices go up, you know, 60% in these things. Because what you do is, where it used to be a controlled market, a small group of investors and things like that would speculate on certain things, now anybody with a computer can go ahead and jump prices up to a certain degree by jumping in the speculation, you know, in the market and speculating on the futures of these products. I hate that the food products and everything else, so much of the market and the pricing relies on the people who are playing the futures game.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the speculators add a lot more volatility to the market. And we saw the same thing with gas prices back in 2008. You remember when it went up to like $140 a barrel for oil? And a large part of that tip was clearly speculation. It was just based on that we hadn't produced as much oil for quite a few years as we had in 2005, and everybody was going, hey, peak oil is a real deal, and all those speculators jumped. There was a bunch of stuff going on. But it definitely exacerbates the peaks and the troughs. I agree with you. I think the speculators are a part of the problem. In this case, though, we do have the reality that there's a lot of dead corn out there. And while there still is enough other corn potentially to feed everybody, we're deciding to turn that into fuel. So
yeah, I would agree. I think that's a huge problem. I mean, that's a huge problem with going out there. But what ends up, my belief is that if you tie that in with, you have a bunch of people speculating on futures, and then because there's this mandate out there for the ethanol people and everything else to produce a certain amount a year, I wonder how much of that is kind of like a double jeopardy thing. It's, you know, the ethanol people have a mandate to create so many billions of barrels of ethanol per year, and then you have people speculating the prices, so the ethanol people buy more futures. And the price, you know, both the things combined,
yeah,
just kind of keep jacking the prices up.
It does just move it up. It does just move it up more and more. And that's why if the ethanol mandate gets moved or changed, we'll probably see the reverse thing as that unwinds. We'll see a drop on the other side. So,
well, considering eating meat, I hope it happens.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of ways to grow meat that, you know, is completely independent of that system. And that's a part of what the whole self-reliance thing is really trying to get disconnected from that, because it's traumatic. Well, first of all, that is not food. You know, the meat they're cranking out in the grocery stores that has all this stuff is hugely, hugely toxic. In fact, I was doing an interview with a doctor recently, and he was saying that if you wanted to reduce your toxicity load by 80%, he said, stop eating the commercial meat supply. There is by far much more toxins in the meat than there is on the vegetables and the produce and the other things grown. And I can give you a real simple story of why that's true. My family's from South Florida. I'm actually a native Floridian. And we go back to visit, you know, mom and the sister and all that. And whenever I do, I like to go to the Everglades. And I was talking to a wildlife biologist, and I said, how is the Florida panther doing? And the biologist was saying, well, the Florida panther is doing really well in the south part of Florida here in the Keys, where their primary diet is the key deer. And the primary thing that the key deer are eating are just grasses and forbs, you know, in and around the Keys. But the Florida panther up in North Florida is having all kinds of problems. They're dying of these strange diseases and weird stuff's going on. The primary diet for the panthers in North Florida are raccoons that are eating garbage and fish and stuff like that. But basically, they're accumulating toxins, and then the panther are eating the raccoons that are full of toxins, and the panthers up in North Florida are dying of strange things.
Well, it definitely shows the chain.
Animals, you know, the higher up the food chain you eat, the more likely you are to have concentrated toxins. And so eating the commercial meat supply, what does it take? Like 10 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of meat? So, you know, you're concentrating your dose of stuff if you're eating the commercial food supply. If you're eating the commercial meat that's grown, you're doing infinitely more damage to your body than if you're growing your own food and you know what's going into those animals. And you're processing themselves. You know it's safe, clean meat. You know what they've been eating. You know, it's a different story. And I do sometimes, you know, the chickens, we do sometimes feed them the feed store corn, which I'm sure is GMO. But I try to give them a lot of other stuff, a lot of other fresh greens and things that can help. You know, a lot of the different pastured poultry guys are saying, you know, if they get a lot of fresh greens, those are blood cleansers, and it can help mitigate the consequences of having given them, sort of like you and I. We eat some junk food every now and then, but then we eat a lot of good stuff to try and compensate and help out a little bit. So,
no, that makes a lot of sense. Well, we got about 4 minutes left, Margie. Do you have any predictions or suggestions for people before we go off on what the rest of this year looks like and what they should do just to be prepared in case we go into a second year of the same situation?
Well, the thing to watch is going to be to watch the weather in, say, South America, because they're just now starting to plant their corn and soybeans. They have a preference for soybeans more than corn just due to some political pressure. So watching the weather internationally, because really we could see, you know, there's one line is the most significant event in human history occurs each year at the harvest. The most significant event in human history occurs each year at the harvest. We forget that. We, you know, watching what else is going on in the rest of the world, and we're still growing a lot of grain, but this, you know, and droughts, hopefully this is just a one-year drought, but droughts don't often just happen to be one-year droughts. I know I'm living in Texas here. We're in a, you know, 4 or 5 year drought. You know, this potentially could be very, 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 very difficult. And, you know, people don't realize we only have, like, basically 12 crops we depend on. The Irish potato famine taught us not to be dependent on just one or two crops. So, you know, if more than anything right now, self-reliance and family-scale food self-reliance is so vitally important. So if I can encourage everybody to start growing their own food, just start with a small garden or a couple of chickens or a few rabbits, anything, but get started with it. Hopefully we're going to mitigate this particular thing and it won't turn into a big crisis, but the potential is there and every year it gets worse.
Yeah, I agree. And do you do updates? I mean, is there a place that people can go to get suggestions of things directly from you on different things that they can grow specifically for feeding their livestock and everything else? Besides your DVD.
Go to the growyourowngroceries.com, and then we have a newsletter, and I'm constantly putting out different ideas for that. In fact, I'm just about to put one together with this gentleman was writing in about how they feed fish from the manure of the chickens. Anyway, but we're always constantly looking at how can you grow food. The easiest and fastest and funnest ways to grow food, and I'm a busy woman, you're a busy woman, I still grow half of my own food. I'm always looking for how can I get some great calories, great tasting, good nutrition, and not putting in as little effort as possible, because you know that's the reality of a modern life. But growyourowngroceries.com, we've not only got the whole video series that will get you started in that, but then there's an ongoing newsletter. We're constantly putting out information on ways to feed things for free or to grow things simply. You might have an oak tree in your front yard. Acorns are a great food source. You know, there's a lot of things around us we just don't think about just because we really haven't had to.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Marjorie, thank you for being on. Guys, we've been talking to Marjorie Wildcraft. She is the creator of the DVD Grow Your Own Groceries. And you can go to www.growyourowngroceries.com. I highly recommend the DVD. It's fantastic. Matter of fact, it's completely changed my mind frame on how I'm doing my property across the street. Now I'm completely looking at redesigning everything. So I really appreciate you being on, Marjorie.
Thanks so much for having me, Bubba. And I'll come up with another really great topic for next month, and we'll have fun. I've really been enjoying this.
I agree 100%. So, guys, we're going to go ahead and take a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll be going live into Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed. So we'll talk to you guys in four commercials. Thanks, Marjorie.
All righty. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Bubba's Bookshelf on the Preparedness Radio Network. Tune in each week to get the insights you need to fill your preparedness library. Questions for Bubba? Contact him at BubbaDaVinci@yahoo.com or visit him on the web at BubbaDaVinci.com. And remember, preparedness saves lives.
Want to reduce your dependence on the electrical grid? Trying to save money on groceries? Preparing for a major power outage? We can help. Layman's is your source for everything you need for heat, food, light, and water when there is no power. Glenda Lehman Irvin here for Layman's in Kidron, Ohio. My father, Jay Lehman, founded our store in 1955 to serve the local Amish with non-electric appliances, tools, and houseware items. Today, through our website, laymans.com, a print catalog, and a retail store, we provide oil lamps, water pumps, wood stoves, canning supplies, and hand tools to customers all over the world. If you think it isn't made anymore, check with Lehman's before you give up. Visit laymans.com or call us at 1-877-438-5346 for a free catalog, or just stop by. We're located about an hour south of Cleveland.
Looking for power grid independence? The Humless Solar Kit is the answer. Increasing brownouts in the U.S. suggest it's time to get a backup. The problem is gas generators are messy, require maintenance, and oh, gas! Which may be scarce in a real emergency. Get the Humless Solar Kit by itself or with a 1,000-watt Humless Sentinel generator. The kit includes a 100-watt solar panel, 20-foot extension cord, LED floodlight, rechargeable flashlights, and more. Become a fan at Humless.com or on Facebook. Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service. Very low shipping and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices, and CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation. Order today and use the promo code E2E for an additional 5% off your order. Did you know that several major European countries are at risk of defaulting on their financial obligations? The U.S. economy will suffer substantially if this happens. Inflation is getting worse, and with a European default, hyperinflation is very possible. If hyperinflation occurs, store shelves will be empty within days and food prices will skyrocket. Will you be able to feed your family when hyperinflation hits? BuyEmergencyFoods.com offers the best kind of emergency food, Legacy Premium, with the largest variety available in the freeze-dried food industry. Each meal is packaged for freshness and individual nitrogen virgin flushed Mylar pouches. The meal pouches are then sealed in stackable heavy-duty plastic containers that are easy to store, easy to transport, and won't be damaged by water or rodents. So if you're worried about food inflation, economic crisis, unemployment, or natural disasters, then don't delay and prepare your family now. Buy your emergency food supply today. Disasters happen. Don't get fooled into thinking that they can't happen to you. Order today and use the promo code E2E and get free shipping and 5% off on every item. You've been listening to the Preparedness Radio Network, offering helpful and timely tips on preparing for natural and man-made disasters. Timely and useful tips on gardening and homesteading. Check us out online at BePreparedRadio.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network. This is the Preparedness Radio Network, preparing you for natural and man-made disasters. Helpful tips on gardening and homesteading. Be prepared. And remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.
We all know that Berkey water purification systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey light systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey light system today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
It's the 21st century, a dangerous world. Preppers need food and medicine. Why not have the best? Enterfood.com does the shopping, prep, and packaging for you using the best organic ingredients on the planet. Right now, specials are available for listeners of this station. The all-organic vegetarian food storage pail and the herbal medicine cabinet. The pail holds up to 120 flavorful meals, super packed fresh to last up to 15 years, soaked, cooked, or raw. The herbal medicine cabinet holds everything you'll need to cure common ailments. Use these items in an emergency or use them when camping. You can't beat these prices. Call to order now, 866-762-9238, 866-762-9238, or go to enerfood.com. That's E-N-E-R-F-O-O-D.com, enerfood.com.
BHM Radio is on the air on the Preparedness Radio Network. BHM Radio is the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine, expanding the stories you love in print live across the net. And now, your hosts for BHM Radio, Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci.
Hey, hey, hey. You are with Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed. This is Bubba Da Vinci, and this week I'm without Colorado Ron.
So, no, you're not.
Hey, you're on. Oh, that you just messed up my whole intro.
You're going to talk bad about me?
I was.
So, surprise.
What happened, man? I thought you were going on road trip.
I totaled my motorcycle yesterday.
Oh, wow. How did you total your motorcycle?
I took a corner a little too fast and scraped my boot on the ground and couldn't recover and slid off into a ravine and endowed the bike, so it's totaled.
Dude, are you okay?
Yeah, believe it or not, I'm actually fine. It's a very... what's the word? It's a very spiritual story, actually.
Well, it had to be surreal. Well, let's go. Talk. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I, the day before I was supposed to leave, Thursday night, my wife informs me that she had a bad feeling that I shouldn't be going on the trip. And she's never done that. As you know, I've made trips to Alaska and Iceland and everywhere else. And she said since the beginning she's had a bad feeling that I shouldn't be on this trip. And I told her, I said, well, it's just because we're so tight gearing up for the next expo that you know, we're kind of stressed out about it. But I really wanted to take the trip because I promised my riding buddies that I'd go. And she said no. And then I said, well, I'm going anyway. So we went to bed, and about five o'clock in the morning, my youngest daughter, she's 5 years old, she woke up screaming in the middle of the night and said that I was going to ride my motorcycle to heaven and never come back.
Wow.
And I said, no, that's not going to happen. Don't worry. And then my wife said, you're still going to go after all that. And I said, yeah, I'm going to go. And anyway, so she was praying and fasting for me, and I told my buddies what had happened, and we all agreed. Well, I mostly agreed with myself, but I said, you know, at what point and at what age do you? It's a fine line between chickening out, and, you know, just because you're getting old and you're a little nervous about getting on the bike, and actually just, you know, getting it done, you know, and making the trip. And you know, if every time I got a little nervous on a trip, I wouldn't have made any of my trips, you know. So anyway, it was a fine line. And about an hour into the trip, we were heading up through the mountains. And about an hour into the trip, I lost it on a corner and totally wiped out. Funny part is, I remember everything. And I landed, it was like landing on a feathered pillow. Even though it was jagged rocks and trees all around me. And matter of fact, the guy that lives right there on the corner came out, and he said that he was amazed. He goes, we've lost 6 motorcyclists in the last year on this corner. And he goes, I'm just glad you're not number 7. And
wow.
I got up and I was fine. I got up and I walked around, and I'm fine this morning. I'm not sore. I literally have not one scratch on me.
Well, I'm glad you're okay. And, you know, I think tomorrow you have a lot of thanking to do in church. That's just an amazing story. You know, it's, I think that maybe the stuff that we do helps us out a little bit, because I know that we've talked about this before. Remember how many things popped up telling me not to go to Singapore? And, you know, I'm glad I didn't get on a plane then. I can't imagine, you know, what would have happened if I had gotten on that plane, because obviously something was telling me not to go. But, you know, my stuff wasn't nearly as I can't think of a better term than in your face than yours. I mean, your daughter and
what?
Well, first of all, Heather's got a great intuition.
She does. And then she'll listen to that to begin with. And then I didn't. And then I started, you know, as I'm laying there sleeping at night or laying in bed, you know, she's asleep and I'm waking up and I'm kind of walking around. I got those, you know, right before the big trip jitters, you know, and I'm like, is it just because what she said is playing in my head and I'm kind of freaking out now? Or is it just, am I done motorcycling? It really what it came down to. Am I done motorcycling? Because it wasn't just this trip for me. It's been really weird. Last 2 weeks, I have not had any interest to get on the motorcycle. And the only reason I was going on this trip was to fulfill an obligation, really.
Right.
The guys that I'd lead them down the trail. So I was actually getting on with with quite a bit of hesitation. And then, you know, with my doc that morning, I should have listened, and I should have told the guys, you know, hey, you know, I should have rode up. I met them and just said, this is what happened. I don't think I'm going, guys. And then turn around and rode home. But I think my motorcycling days are over, to be honest.
Wow. Well, that's a hell of a realization to have. And not a good way to do it. I guess that you got to be thankful that you didn't get hurt.
Yeah,
because a lot of people end up getting hurt and then making the decision that that they're not going to do something anymore.
Yep.
I mean, even though you had the accident, and is the bike totaled, you said?
Oh yeah, the bike's totaled. Forks are bent. I actually cracked one of the front brake rotors, bent the front wheel, bent the handlebars, and then when it endoed, it landed right on the front where the headlight and all the gauge cluster is, and that just smashed it all into the gas tank and popped a hole in the gas tank. And yeah, it's gone.
So have you gone to see a doctor?
No. Nope, I got it. It happened yesterday morning about 10 o'clock.
Okay, and you're not really feeling it today, so I guess you're okay.
Not feeling a thing. I mean, it's really weird. I mean, it's funny because I've laid my motorcycle down in the driveway and I've had more pain. You know what I mean? Just tipping it over and
mm-hmm.
I remember grabbing for the concrete because I was going back. I was going down on the concrete in the driveway because I'd hit one of the big rocks one of the kids left out in the driveway, and I twisted my doggone wrist and hurt for 2 weeks. And I've had more pain laying the bike down in the driveway at 0 miles an hour than I did leaving the road at 50, I was doing 55 when I left the road.
So, you were doing 55?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm just shocked that you're not, and grateful that you're not hurt, but shocked that you're not hurt. At 55 miles an hour, I'd expect you to be definitely feeling a little bit messed up today.
I totally expected it too. I was, as a matter of fact, we had helmet mics in our helmets, and the guys were laughing afterwards, you know, after the fact, because I said, "Oh, this is going to hurt." And I went off, and I was doing my best to keep it under control, and I went up this embankment and missed all the trees, and I was like, "Okay, I'm going to," you know, and I had full intentions of, I had it under control, and I was going right back onto the road. And I hit this big ravine that was about a 2 foot drop, and instantly stopped the motorcycle. Just boom, and endowed it, and I just went over the handlebars and went flying about 10 feet away. So, just yeah,
well, and
could
you,
do.
And you still got up and did the radio show this morning. I'm impressed. I mean, that's. The whole rest of it's an impressive story and everything else, and then I'm like, damn, and then he still gets up. I almost didn't want to get up this morning just because my back hurt from moving a refrigerator.
Oh, my goodness. What do you do, man? What do? You got to move on. It was almost nice, though. It was like a weight lift off.
I'm losing you, Ron. I don't know if it's me or if it's you.
Oh, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear
Hello.
You now. Well,
I'm
checking with our producer. Not sure. Okay, you're better. Yeah, you're better now. I don't know if it was we were all losing you.
I turned towards the fan. I was trying to cool off. We had just passed a town about a half mile before the wreck, and so one of the guys gave me a ride back to that little town, and I was just sitting there thinking, you know, while I was waiting on my wife. And it was like a huge weight off my shoulders when I finally told myself, you know, and I was, you know, pretty much talking to myself, and I said, all right, that's it. I'm done riding motorcycles. I'm selling all my motorcycle gear, all my motorcycle stuff. It's over. And it was just like this big...
It's too bad you had to total your bike before you sold, before you had to realize it.
Yeah. Plus, I've got a lot of nice riding gear, so it kind of sucks too. I just bought some new boots and stuff. But it probably won't save my chops, so I can't complain.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. Well, like I said, I'm glad you're okay. You should probably take it light this week, just because you know, you never know when it's going to hit you if you're all bruised and messed up. But yeah, just kind of take it back, take it easy for the rest of the after, for the rest of the day. You got to be back on it because you got church tomorrow, and then we got, you know, you're what, we're almost exactly 4 weeks away. Actually, we're less than 4 weeks away. We're 3.5 weeks away now, right? From the Hickory event. Yikes.
Yep. I know.
So, well, let's tell the audience about what we're doing today. Today we have on Charles Sanders. Charles is a contributing author to Backwoods Home Magazine. He's written many, many articles on lots and lots of topics. I want to say it's something like 15 or 20 different articles he's written for Backwoods Home Magazine. And we talked to him back in April, and we talked to him about homesteading and everything else. And today I think we're going to have him on, and we'll touch base on, you know, where he's at with his homesteading and everything else. But we had a conversation the first hour. We were on Bubba's Bookshelf, and we were talking with Marjorie Wildcraft, and I wanted to kind of touch base with him a little bit more about how this drought that's happening, 61% of the country is now in drought, and both corn and soy prices are through the roof. And several of the articles that Charles has written have been about raising your own cattle and animals for your homestead, and even beekeeping. And I'm wondering, as a homesteader, which is different than Marjorie, who does, she's also a homesteader, but looks at it from the, you know, from a different perspective, how this drought affects him and what he, how he thinks it'll affect the new person that's coming into homesteading. And you guys have been fine, right, Colorado? You guys really haven't, the drought hasn't affected you very much.
Not too much, no. We're doing okay.
Now, what about as far as, are you seeing the increase in beef prices and, you know, milk? And are all the prices going up like they are, you know, in the other areas? Do you see an increase in costs?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everything's gone up. You know, even though we're not in a drought, I guess a lot of our stuff's either imported or they're just jumping on the drought bandwagon because, yes, the prices are definitely going up.
Well, it's the prices are going up, number one, because, you know, the increase in corn costs, corn is used in ethanol, so there's an increase in fuel costs. And then on top of that, you know, prices go up, you know, as Marjorie was saying, 70% of the products inside the store touch corn. So
yeah.
Or have corn in their chain. So basically when corn prices go up 63%, yeah, that's going to raise the cost of all the products that fall, that come from, that utilize corn. And so that's, I think that's where you're seeing a lot of the pricing, you know, jump up significantly.
Right. It's just like, you know, when Russia had all the fires, I think it was like 2 years ago now, and wheat. The funny thing is the problem, you know, they said, okay, well, you know, wheat's going to go up because Russia lost all their wheat fields, basically. Okay, so we expected that. But the next year, I believe they're growing wheat again, and the prices haven't come down. So it's very interesting to see what's going to happen once corn prices go up. It reminds me of the gas prices. You know, they go up, then they come down just a little. Then they go up more, and they come down just a little, just to figure out where people are not, you know, we're not complaining about $3.50 for gas anymore. So, you know, they think that that's a sweet spot, it seems like. You know what I mean?
No, that's actually not a bad – there's a conspiracy theory, but, I mean, that's not a bad one to necessarily look at because I think you're right. You know, when I was over in the U.K. driving, you know, they're used to $5, $6, $7 a gallon. And I was just – I literally – you know, almost fainted the first time I filled up the tank, and I'm like, holy crap, I can't believe that this is, yeah, the prices are this high. And they're just used to it, but we aren't. And, you know, it doesn't seem like that long ago when we were looking at a buck or two a gallon, and I was whining about that, And if it got down to $2 a gallon now, I'd be, just saving, singing praises and going, oh, look, we're back. But you're right. I don't blink an eye at $3.50 a gallon. I mean, it hurts, and I'm a little more conservative about where I drive. But, quite frankly, shouldn't we all be doing that anyway? I mean, if obviously, yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think you're right. And the thing is that, the fact of the matter is gas is not going to go back down. As a businessman, let's just look at it that way. Strictly as a businessman, if I know that 80% of my traffic is more than willing to pay $3.50 a gallon, why would I drop the price to $2 a gallon? Doesn't make any sense.
No, I agree with you. As a businessman, I always look at two things. It's like these car manufacturers. They're saying that they're seeing a huge reduction in the number of cars that are sold annually. And I keep wondering, why someone just doesn't come out and put out a $6,000 truck again. And everyone's like, well, they couldn't afford to do that. And I go, that's not necessarily true. It's purely a numbers game, right? If you're selling, 50,000 trucks a year at $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, depending on what type of model it is and everything else, wouldn't you make the same amount of profit if you're selling twice as many cars, but you've lowered the price by, 50%, where it's in an affordable range for a larger group of people.
Right. But they won't do that because the, it's more stress on their equipment. It's more, they have to ramp up production for the same cost. So it doesn't seem to make any sense. Instead of building, let's just use easy numbers. Instead of building 100 trucks a day, they're going to build 1,000 trucks a day. Well, that's just harder on their equipment and for the same amount of profit. So why not just keep it to where it is?
Yeah, but it's about market saturation, isn't it? I mean, if that's not to say that you might not increase your numbers. I wish someone would try it just once.
I agree. Yeah, I wish they would.
Because I really believe that if you put out a car that was at a lower price, that more people could afford to get newer cars, that you'd probably sell a significantly amount of more, and it would be better for the economy because less people would be financing it. People are in over their heads because they're financing these $20,000-$30,000 cars, $30,000 even more, I don't know. Like I said, all speculation. I agree with you. I don't see the gas prices ever going down again. I think they found a sweet spot that from $2.99 to $3.99, people are fairly comfortable. They'll whine a little bit, but they'll still pay the price. And by the time my daughters are old enough to drive, they'll have conditioned everybody else. My daughters will never have known a gas price under $3.
Right. And it just makes me sound old.
Go ahead.
I remember when it was below a dollar. It just makes me sound old.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember
a
good day.
When you do that. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So did you ever see the movie Hunger Games?
I did. Uh-huh.
What did you think about it?
Well, to be honest, I'd never read the book, never heard anything about it. I didn't know, I'm not in the loop on Hunger Games at all. And honestly, I went into it with a blank slate. I didn't even know what it was about, really. I just went with a date with my wife, and I thought it was a terrible movie myself. So I just
really?
Thought it was, I didn't. And everybody tells me, oh, that was the greatest movie ever. And I think, what in the world are we teaching our kids when, killing a bunch of teenagers running around killing each other? It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, it made sense, but I thought it was just a horrible message.
Well, it's a political statement. I mean, it's kind of interesting you went that direction. I really didn't think you would. The movie got released last night at midnight. And, Walmart stayed open. They had a midnight, and they haven't done this for a movie in years, where they actually opened at mid. There's such a demand for this thing that, you know, they actually had midnight openings of stores. They do that for like video game console systems, rarely ever for a movie. I can't think of a movie they've done it for since the Star Wars movies, maybe. And it was a midnight opening last night, and the movie was so popular that iTunes has been locked up, and you haven't been able to purchase anything on iTunes since midnight last night because it's just been jammed with the number of people trying to download the movie.
Wow.
It's been very interesting because the movie has done a lot for the self-reliance movement, because the principle of the movie is that you kind of have to, you know, that the government, that the people rose up against the government had enough control to push everything back, and so they've segmented everybody into smaller groups so they're manageable and don't let them all get together. And the Hunger Games is just a way to kind of keep everybody in check,
right?
You know, and remind them that the sins of their past.
And that part, it was kind of crazy that, you know, that they were doing that. And I, like I said, I wasn't expecting to go and watch a bunch of teenage kids killing themselves. And that's where that was the part, I guess, that really threw me off. You know what I mean? I just expecting it. It was just like, wow.
Right. And I think if you have, and I just checked with iTunes, you can still not make purchases because their system is overloaded. I mean, it's been this way since midnight last night.
Wow.
Yeah, I am amazed at how popular this movie is, and I guess it was perfect timing. The book series and obviously the movie, with the way the economy is and as many displeased and the, you know, which has kind of died down, but the Occupy movement. You know, it was perfect timing for this movie to be released, for it to be this huge. Actually, you know, I just thought of the Harry Potter movies. The first couple of Harry Potter movies, I think, might have done midnight openings when they came out. So it wasn't the Star Wars. I think Harry Potter did it. But, again, for a movie that's this politically slanted and talking about, you know, people not having enough to eat, and everything else, I'm truly shocked that this has become so mainstream.
Well, yeah, that is true. That is true. I mean, it was pretty crazy, you know, like I said, that they split them up like that and got them, you know, fighting each other. It was unreal.
Yeah. Well, again, you haven't read the book, so it's the whole thing is definitely much deeper. And, I can't imagine them. The movie was so successful that I can't imagine them waiting too long before they put out a second movie. But just wow,
huh.
Yeah, pretty cool. So, how's everything going for Hickory? How are you feeling?
It's great. Yeah, we've got so many advertising locations that we're doing. It's going to be great. I'm excited that we were able to, you know, kind of team up a little bit with the gun show there, and they're helping promote, and we're kind of going back and forth on that. And we've got, you know, a lot of our vendors are starting to sign up. We got just about everything in place. I'm really excited about the educational portion of this one. We've got a lot of classes. You know, like meat canning classes and just different things like that. You know, we'll have gardening classes and home security classes. And, you know, it's just, I'm excited. This one's going to have a lot of education, a lot more education than the others.
Well, good. I mean, I'm excited about getting out there, and hopefully the weather's nice when we get out to North Carolina. September's, you know, we're starting to get into fall, and we're definitely feeling it here. And I love the East Coast in the fall. Yeah, I'm not a big
I,
the humidity out there is too harsh. And otherwise,
if we had more time and we didn't have to gear up for Mesa, you know, 5 weeks later, I would I'd make it a family event and just cruise up and down the coastline there in the fall, let the kids see all the colors changing and all that.
Yeah, I think it'd be a lot of fun. Yeah, but unfortunately, it's actually we have a little over a month. Yeah, it's like just exactly 5 weeks, isn't it, between the next two events?
Yeah, I don't know what we were thinking.
I don't know either. All right. What we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and take a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll be live with Charles Sanders. Again, Charles is a contributor to Backwoods Home Magazine. He's got, I haven't counted, but I think at least 20 articles out there. And we'll be chatting with him about homesteading and what's going on and get his feel on how this drought and everything's affecting the people. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a commercial break. When we're back, we'll be back with Charles. Thanks.
You're listening to the Preparedness Radio Network. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disaster situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just a conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Thanks for listening to A Word from Our Sponsor. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Hey, 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 you're live with Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed, with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci, a very lucky Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci. So, we're going to be live with Charles Sanders. Charles, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
How are you today?
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you guys?
I'm doing fine. Colorado apparently decided that he wanted to take flying lessons and flew over the handle of his handlebars of his motorcycle. But other than that, I think we're doing good.
Ouch.
So, how's everything? Where are you located, Charles? I forgot. You're in Eastern Time.
Yes, sir. I'm in southwestern Indiana. We're just about, about 30 miles from the central time zone, but we're in southwestern Indiana.
That's right, Indiana. So, you know, I was telling people earlier that, some of the articles you've written for Backwoods Home Magazine have been about raising your own beef and, you know, beekeeping. And having your own vegetable gardens and all that stuff. How has the drought, which has taken over about 60% of the country this year, affected you in those areas?
Well, me personally, it has affected our garden in an extreme, and then also any hay that we've had over on our places has also been affected, severely cut back the hay production. And the garden, you know, basically we didn't have a green bean crop. It was dried up. Just about everything else have been affected as well. The farmers in the local area, they're seeing all kinds of effects. I could describe some of those to you if you'd like.
Well, as a homesteader, I mean, that has to affect not only just your production for the year and being your ability to be prepared, but, you know, the bottom line in general, because I'm assuming, like we've had to do here, cost of feed has gone up, and since there's less grass because of less rain, you know, a lot of people are having to subsidize if they're free ranging their cattle or their goats or whatever. A lot of them have had to go and buy alfalfa and hay and buy feed to subsidize to keep their herds up. I would assume it's the same there.
Very much so. In fact, those who, you know, once you do the cost-benefit ratio, you know, the analysis on that, a lot of producers are just getting out of it. Even the small producers with, several, you know, a dozen head or so, they're just saying it's not worth it. I know recently that square bales, around here you're talking a 40 to 50-pound square bale, not the huge square bales we see in the West, but a square bale of alfalfa hay is going for as much as $16 to $20, and that's just something you can't feed much of and still stay above board with it.
Well, that's like about, I mean, I don't know about your area, that'd be about a 50% increase in this area in cost. What is that about?
I'd say it's closer to two-thirds for our area. Normally alfalfa hay is much, much less than that. And most folks, I would guess, that are feeding a mixture of alfalfa and orchard grass, some type of mix hay. But just the good alfalfa stuff usually goes for, you know, $6 or $8 a bale, I'd guess. But it's way up there now.
So, I mean, it's kind of put everybody in a conundrum, right? Because more and more people are trying to get back to basics and become more self-reliant.
Yes.
But this and the economy is in dire straits, and so there's not as much disposable income to get into this. And then like a triple whammy, then, you know, what it turns around is we get hit with this drought, which now it becomes almost cost prohibitive to become self-reliant.
It in some cases it can. You certainly have to establish priorities. Maybe instead of getting a calf, you're going to go, you'll get a half dozen rabbits, or, you know, decide to switch to something else, maybe goats, something that doesn't consume as much feed. You may decide to get out of it altogether and maybe barter, you know, if you have bees, honey, or eggs, or apples, or something like that for some of your meat. You know, there's a lot of avenues there to explore, and a lot of them that have to be considered. There's, you know, the corn prices as well. You know, normally farmers here who are beginning to think about harvesting about now would be thinking about 150 to 200 bushels of corn to the acre, and I know because of the early onset of the harvest season, there's farmers here that are seeing 0 to 50 bushels of corn to the acre. So that's going to have a tremendous effect, not only for homesteaders, but for the whole economy down the road.
Right. And that's exactly what we were talking about earlier in the earlier sessions, was that this isn't a short-term effect. You know, people don't realize that the corn, that the higher yield the corn we typically get is what everybody uses to get them through the winter. And winter prices already increase from the rest of the year. So now with the reduction of actual of access to that corn, those prices theoretically are going to skyrocket come when winter comes.
Yes, and as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this or anything, but as I understand it, there's a tremendous amount of our corn is designated by federal mandate to be used for ethanol production before we can start using corn for food production. And that's going to have an effect as well.
Yeah, Congress and the Senate are right now, they've requested a vote to lower the mandate or for at least this season to stop the mandate for it because
Excellent.
Of the need of feed for the season. But,
I think that
this last week.
Yeah, I think that would be prudent for this season particularly.
Well, now, I'm kind of curious on bee production. Have you noticed any difference there?
On what production, sir?
Bees.
Bees? Actually, you know, that I think they're still the wildflowers. There's plenty of those. Alfalfa would have been down somewhat, so if you live in a high agricultural area, that would have been affected if you depend on sometimes soybeans or alfalfa for your main bloom crop. But the seasonal wildflowers and stuff, there is a bloom of. I haven't talked with any beekeepers here around that have taken honey off this year, so I don't really know. I can't tell you what how much they're down.
Are you saying now you keep your own bees, is that correct?
I don't have any at this time. I've recently, in the last few years, got rid of mine, and I don't have any at this time. But one of my neighbors does, and he and I have talked about it, and I helped him capture a swarm here earlier in the season. But I don't have any here at home.
Okay. Because, I just noticed this year I'm not seeing as many bees around the local area. But, of course, we're kind of like you, which is all the gardens, everything seems to have just pretty much died this year. There was really not much blooming anywhere in this area.
And I think the bees have been hard hit anyway by a couple of biological pests, naturally occurring or whatever. But they've been affected the last season or two as well. So it will be interesting to see how they fare over the fall and winter. It certainly could develop where, the home beekeeper would simply just not have enough to take much of the surplus off and then be required to leave it for their overwintering of their hives.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. So, Charles, you have a book out which is based on homesteading.
Yes.
And, do you see that do you think this year is going to be it's amazing, because of the economy and because of drought, do you think it's going to be harder for people to get started this year than in past years?
Oh, boy. I think it might be a bit more difficult to get started. The cost of all the inputs is going to increase, I believe. But I think you're going to see more and more people who are attempting to get started and become more involved in it if they are already started. Just because of the effects on the economy and the uncertainty of things, the weather system that we've been having during the summer just adds to all that and makes a lot of folks kind of sit up and take notice about the uncertainties in the world and what they can do to help ensure for their family a little bit more. So I don't think it will decrease the number of people attempting to start homesteading. I think rather it might help to increase it. But I do believe that the cost and the input will be more expensive.
Now, as far as a new homesteader, what are some of the...
I lost you there.
Ron, you're fading out again. There you go.
What are some of the steps? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of us still wanting to.
I'm having real difficulty hearing him.
Yeah, Ron, I think you're going to need to Ron, you're breaking up. You'll have to re-jump in. All right, I think I can ask it. Yeah, I'll ask the question I think he's trying to get. I can hear part of it.
Okay, great.
He was saying that, you know, a lot of people, like, as you stated, there's a lot more people that are looking to try to get into this, even with the prices increasing and everything else. What would you say are the smartest first steps for anyone that's looking to get into homesteading? And I think this is probably a real important time to kind of go through this because, as you said, input costs are increasing.
Yes.
And so making sure that you're doing it intelligently and have a plan is probably more important than ever when you're trying to get into this. So what would you say the first steps for any homesteader?
The first step, once you decide, is that you're going to be involved in homesteading, and I would say, just in a nutshell, to begin where you are. You may not have the homestead that you want. You may not have the 4 or 5 acres or the 10 or 20 acres or whatever, but I think we touched on this briefly the last time we spoke, that you can do a lot with a little piece of land. You can have a flock of chickens. You can have a few cages with some rabbits. You can have a lot of garden and berry bushes, and you can do a lot on a small piece of land that can really have a positive effect on your family situation and your security. And then I just keep learning. That's one thing about the book that I wrote there several years ago. It was for beginners. It was for folks who weren't really well versed in homesteading, maybe looking to make that plunge, that trip into the country and begin living. And it offers a lot of basic advice on a lot of different topics. But certainly begin where you are and just do all that you can with the place that you have would probably be my first advice.
Okay. And what, you know, I remember we covered this before. What would be optimal, obviously, more people would want more land than less land, but what would you say a decent-sized piece of property to start with? I mean, is it an acre? Is it 2 acres?
I think ideally, in fact, it's the title of one of my favorite books. It was written back in the mid-30s. Is called 5 Acres and Independence. That's available, I think, still through Dover Press. And it's a great old book with a lot of basic information on just setting up a homestead, a small place. And there again, it talks about 5 acres. Another book that I really like is The Have More Plan. It's another book that was written back in the mid-40s, and they talk about using, I think, a 5-acre, 6-acre homestead. So that's a really good target, something that even with land prices like they are, that is something that's quite doable for most, I won't say most folks, but a lot of folks, and most folks if they really put their mind to it.
Hello, Ron, did you make it back?
Hello, can you hear me?
All right. Oh, there he is. Okay.
Yep.
I thought it said you were back on.
All right, I'm here. Sorry, I missed some of the conversation. Go ahead.
That's okay. So, all right, so if you're looking at 3 to 5 acres, Charles, and let's say we even have an acre or two,
uh-huh.
And we're talking basic steps. I've acquired my property. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to start getting started. You know, I've heard probably about 4 or 5 different opinions on this, so I'd love to hear where you are. What's the next step on your, you know, what's your first acquisition? Is it go out there and set up the garden first? Is it go out there and get your chickens and start your livestock first? Is it, you know, where do you start? Because I think that's very confusing for most people. And I think one of the biggest problems that everybody runs into is everybody tries to do everything at once. They go out there and
yes,
they grab the chickens, they grab the rabbits, they grab the garden, and none of it gets – it's hard to manage that many new things at one time and do it successfully.
It is that. And those you've really got a good snapshot of what happens a lot of times. And, you know, go with what you're interested in. If you're interested in growing the garden, you know, that's probably should be – an early consideration, if not the first, because you can get you can certainly get lettuce and radishes, and you can get a lot of vegetables going within a matter of days. So once you get some ground, a spot tilled up on your garden, and get some seeds going, that's a monumental first step. It's an accomplishment, and it's really, to a newcomer, that is really something to see and to be able to produce some of your food right there on your own place. It's a great feeling. I can remember that. Next, if you decide you want to try livestock, chickens are certainly a good place to start. And as I mentioned, rabbits, they don't take up much space. They're pretty easy to work with, and they produce a lot of good high-protein meat as well as fertilizer for the garden. So either one of those, chickens or rabbits, are both really, really good small animals and don't take up a lot of space. And from there, as you become comfortable with it, adding a fruit tree or two, maybe some blueberry bushes, blackberries, raspberries, that kind of thing, you can do a few at a time. And there again, like you said, don't put in so many that you become overwhelmed with it. Many first-timers or beginners are also still working a 40 or 50-hour-a-week job. So it can become drudgery pretty quickly, and you can become disillusioned. So that's something you have to be conscious of and guard against.
Yeah, I think the one thing that a lot of people are stressing about are, obviously, we're seeing, prices going up, and, people are kind of getting nervous, and they're getting itchy. So, for me, for instance, I've only been in this location for 2 years, and I have had overwhelming need to be prepared. And so I have, I've done, the gardening, I put in all the fruit orchard, the berry orchard, or the berry patch, I've got the rabbits, I've got the quail. As of right now, I'm doing okay. I don't feel overwhelmed just yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's where this overwhelming sensation comes from, is that people are nervous about what the future holds, and that's why they're trying to hurry up and get set up before it's too late. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there is. There's a great deal of anxiety about our country, the economy, and I dare say the political climate, attitudes and things. So it's a matter of great concern. And I will say politically liberal folks that I know are also seeing the need to get into chickens and gardening and home food production. And so it's not restricted to those of us who are more conservative or in our ways of thinking. So a lot of folks are seeing it all across the board, I believe.
Yeah, the problem is, like we said, you can get into it and get overwhelmed and actually totally ruin your whole experience of doing this.
Yes, it becomes drudgery.
Exactly. Exactly, and so what I have tried to do, and I don't know if you've touched on this at all, but I try to automate as much as I can without depending too much on on fancy systems or anything like that. But I try to automate things, such as instead of a little water tank that I got to constantly fill up for the chickens. I put a lot bigger water tank in there that only needs filled up, once every couple of days. Things like that. And so I'm constantly looking to figure out how to reduce the time it takes for me to maintain.
Sure, and that's just a matter of good economics of time. I mean, that's certainly, and the more a person does that, the light switch will come on one of these days, and you say, hey, I could do this and save a lot of time. Or even the way you have your farmstead laid out, the distance from barn to shed, from house to barn, the layout can save a lot of, over a year's time, save a few miles in walking, carrying a bucket of feed or whatever. So it's, there's economics there as well.
That's a really good point. What were some, when you were first starting out on this, or somebody that's a first timer and they're just starting out, what are probably some easy time saving tips that a lot of the new guys make the mistake of doing or don't do?
Well, I'll mention one in gardening. One that always comes to mind quickly is learn to mulch. Once you get your garden up, you get it growing. I always go through and weed it really well. Then my wife and I will put down a layer of newspaper, just a single layer of newspapers, and a thick layer of straw. And then from then on, the rest of the growing season is just a matter of, while you're picking the vegetables, just plucking a stray weed here or there. The straw keeps the weeds from coming up through. You don't have to constantly till. You don't have to constantly weed. And as an added benefit, it all breaks down and can be tilled into the garden in the fall.
Nice.
And that, while it takes a little bit, it takes a few hours to get it done initially, it saves many, many hours over the course of the summer in weeding and keeping the garden healthy looking.
Well, that's a great tip, and that's one I haven't done yet. So thanks for that one.
Yeah, I recommend that. That's one of that I learned early on, and being a lazy gardener like I am, I like to take advantage of that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I feel the same way. Another thing that we're trying to figure out is honestly how to calculate without overcalculating, how much production we need to feed our family. For instance, rabbits. We're calculating if we want a rabbit or two a week. How many rabbits do we need in order to calculate, and figure out how many hutches we need to get set up to feed our family?
For a family of, let's say four, you have two or three does, and if you breed them, it's going to be, you're going to have a couple litters a season easily. And each one of those will be a pound and a half, 2 pounds. So of the fryers, each doe can have anywhere from, I'd say 5 to 10. I know I had the last ones I butchered, I had two does. I think I butchered 17 young fryers there one morning, and they were a couple pounds apiece. So that's quite a bit of meat right there.
It is
34 pounds of meat. And it's all real good stuff. You can fry it up just in pieces, thighs and the legs and that kind of thing. Or you can cook it down and put it in just any cooked dish, casserole or stew or whatever, as you would any other type of meat. And it's a light meat, light texture, very nutritional, and it's really, really good meat. Tame rabbit's really good meat. Chicken similar. You can get... Here, a friend of mine just down the road bought, he got 100 Cornish cross chickens here just this past week, and he's going to grow them out to fryer size here in about 8 to 10 weeks, and he'll be butchering those. That'll be his third batch for the season. So you can produce a lot on the small place. Now, calculating the needs, I would guess, needs versus what we like is a little different. I would say 2 pounds, a couple pounds of meat in a dish. That would last a couple of days anyway for a family of four. I don't know, depending on how much leftovers you eat and what you add to it. But those 17 little fryers can go a pretty long way.
So, Charles, let me ask you a question.
I don't know if that's answering your question sufficiently. I don't know of a formula per se to help in that regard. You just have to base it on the amount of meat that you normally eat and just kind of figure it from there, what you like to eat and how often you eat and, meat and that kind of thing would help you get that equation going.
So,
yeah,
Charles,
did help. Sorry. Go ahead, Bubba.
That's okay. No, that's all right. I was just trying to get across. How long have you been raising rabbits, Charles?
There again, on the place we're at right now, I don't know if you recall, but we're not on our original homestead at this time. We're in an adjacent county on just a small tract. But I had raised them for a few years. I don't even know how many years.
So how, you know, kind of trying to segue here a little bit, but staying on the same topic. How does rabbit can? I mean, is it a fairly decent meat to can up? You know, Colorado Ron and I have been talking about canning meats. Because with the corn prices going up and all the prices going up, obviously people need to make sure that they're stocked up on as much meat as they possibly can in case the prices really go through the roof. And I've seen recipes for canning beef, for canning fish, for canning chicken. I've never seen anybody canning rabbit.
Well, and you can add me to that list. I've never canned rabbit. We've usually frozen it, but I would say it would be very similar to canning chicken. If you have information on that, it should do nicely. I'm certain it'd soften the bones up, but it would certainly can up, and you'd be able to use it just like you would canned chicken. It would probably be something, I don't know if you'd want to debone it all before you canned it. I probably wouldn't. I'd probably just pack the pieces in and put water on it to kind of make a broth and use it that way.
Okay.
But hey, certainly, go ahead.
No, I was glad. It would certainly what?
It would certainly be, it would be beneficial if you didn't have a freezer or a different way of keeping it. That would certainly be a good way of doing it.
Yeah, I would think so. And Colorado, what are you up to in your rabbits now?
We've got a half a dozen, and they're just about breeding age, so we're going to start ramping that up right here.
Oh, that's great.
And so, for a typical rabbit, what's the average rabbit weight that you look at, Charles, when you start processing them?
What's the average size?
Yeah.
Obviously that's going to matter per rabbit. I mean, per breed, I'm assuming. But I mean, how long do you let them mature? I mean, before you start processing the rabbits, is it for fryers?
I'm trying to think here. I would have to look that up. I don't remember how old they were. I don't know, 3 or 4 pounds, probably live weight, something like that, or maybe even a little bit more. But they dressed out a couple pounds, a few pounds a piece. And I'm looking here. I grabbed a book off the shelf while we were speaking. The Stocking Up books, I don't know if you're familiar with those. They're pretty much an old standby. Stocking Up does have some good instructions on canning poultry, small game, and rabbit. Different directions for doing it with the bones, without the bone, etc. So there are. It's got recommendations for quartz and etc. But it's the Stocking Up book is certainly a good one for anybody to have who's going to be canning or freezing or processing meats, vegetables,
and is
fruit,
that
kind of thing.
Is that S-T-O-C-K or S-T-A-L-K? Like stocking,
no,
stocking
up
an animal?
S-T-O-C-K-I-N-G, Stocking Up. And I think this edition, I've got the original edition. I also have a copy of Stocking Up 3, which I don't know if that's the latest edition or not. And I think it was originally put out by Rodale Press. But it's
have you ever heard of that, Colorado?
I haven't. I've not heard of that.
Yeah, it is an old standby. It just covers just about every facet of food preservation that you can imagine. Even includes drying, juicing, that kind of thing. So I would recommend you might want to research that one a little bit.
Well, that's a good one to add to our readers' list of books. I've never even heard of it. So now you comment in one of your blogs, older blogs or older emails or articles, that tomato is your go-to crop.
Yes.
How are your tomatoes this year?
Well, they were affected by the drought. We've gotten several. In fact, I'm going to be picking more of them today. They've done okay, but they had a lot of blossom end rot. and I'm not sure. Sometimes that's a cause by lack of calcium. I'm not sure exactly what it is. I don't know what effect the drought had on it, but it seems like it had a lot of that this year. I also had the size of them just simply wasn't as good. They were just smaller. But we've had enough to can a few, to make some. We've made 8 or 10 gallons of salsa. We've started making some pizza sauce that we like to make homemade pizzas, and we've made some of that. And so we've got enough to use, but there wasn't an overabundance of them in the garden, certainly.
Yeah, that's the same here. And that's why it's important to continue to stock up. We still look for like case lot sales and things like that to try and offset it while we're growing our production, because I believe that's another issue a lot of people have is they plant their garden and then stop looking at buying in bulk because they're thinking they're going to get it out of their garden, and then once or twice.
Well, as a matter of fact, I had to do exactly that this year. Our bean crop basically failed. We were able to pick a couple, 3 messes to eat, but those that we would normally can, dozens of quarts, and we just simply didn't have them. They just dried up. And I ended up going to one of the places where we do stock up, and I've picked up a case or two of canned green beans now just to put on the shelf. But fortunately, we had some home canned green beans. We have a few left from last year, so we're going to be in good shape. But it's like you said, it's still keep in mind that you might have to stock up a little bit from other sources as well.
Yeah. Now, do you have good sources? Are they only is your sources only local, or is it something where you go nationwide, or?
Some of both. I've got a lot of. I live near, right on the edge of an Amish community, and I have a lot of good friends up there. There's some produce auctions where I've been to get really good quality produce, good prices on it. And then at other times the prices are outlandish and I can't afford it. But that's a good source. I've been able to get things there. Been able to go to a local store where we do a lot of stocking up, and they have good prices. I don't have anything close by like a Sam's or a Costco or anything like that. I've done just a little bit of mail order, but that's mostly on grains and things like that.
Interesting. Interesting. So, another thing is, where do you go to buy like bulk feed for some of your animals, such as rabbits and things like that? Because I've gone to 2 or 3 different places, and I was kind of shocked to see that the prices have varied quite a bit.
And yes, that's true. They're just local feed mills around here is where I've gotten all my feed. I just have a blend of rabbit. In particular, I usually just buy the pellets. For cattle, I have just a simple formula that I've used of corn and supplement and a little bit of just a little dab of salt and some molasses sweet feed in there to kind of make it more palatable to them. And they mix it any way you want it. So just take the feed sacks over and they grind it up and fill the sacks and you throw them in the truck and away you go. Rabbits, like I say, I usually buy pellet feed. Chickens are the same. I usually purchase a laying mash or growing mash, depending on what I'm doing.
Now, on this feed, I'm looking at a bulk purchasing a bunch of feed for my animals so that I can help with the prices of feed that are going to rise. Now, putting this in, like, say, those plastic 30-gallon trash cans, will that work? Or
On the small animals, I usually have I bought a trash can, just a metal trash can. I'd set the sack or pour the feed into it, and just keep it tightly covered so the vermin can't get in. And make sure it doesn't draw moisture. That'll spoil your feed. It'll start to mold. Just make sure it stays dry and covered. On the large animal feed, I just simply use an old chest freezer and I would set the feed sacks down in it and drop the lid on it, and it would keep it dry and until it was all used. It just makes sort of kind of like a feed bin, sort of recycling the freezer in that way.
Oh, I like that. All right. Go ahead, Carl.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
I was just going to say I was reading your blog, and I don't know if everybody knows. Charles has a blog. It's selfreliant homestead.blogspot.com. Wow, tongue twister. And when I was reading it the other day before yesterday, I mean it was yesterday I was reading it. But anyway, either way, you just started doing apple cider, and I was amazed that you guys were actually using a old apple cider press. I mean, this thing's like 150 years old.
Yeah, it was a neat machine. I took several pictures of that over at the friend's house there. I was really impressed with that. I had an uncle who had a similar one. It wasn't an antique one. He had built it, and we used it for several years. Unfortunately, he and the press both are long gone, but the neighbors invited me over to help with this, and it was really neat to see this old cider press still at work.
But I noticed in one of your photographs, was this thing being run by a motor also? It had a new motor that was attached to it?
It does have a gas motor on it. That runs the crusher. In the narrative there, I tried to describe, we were chunking up the apples, hundreds of pounds of apples. We'd cut them into half or into thirds or fourths, kind of looking for worms at the same time. And would toss them into a bucket. Then we'd empty the bucket into this wooden hopper that feeds into the crusher. It simply just crushes the apples up where they can press more juice out. And that crusher is run by a small gasoline motor. As the hopper is filled, it's slid over underneath the apple press itself, and that is just simple turn screw that you lay a pole, a stout piece of wood in, and just walk around the whole machine. It's a 4 or 5 foot long piece of wood, and just walk around the machine turning that turn screw and pressing the juice out of the apples.
And obviously this is unpasteurized apple cider. How long can you store something like that?
It doesn't keep very well unless you would can it. The folks over there, like I say, these are Amish folk, and they actually keep a freezer facility. There's a nearby business over there. They have a refrigerated facility there, and folks will rent out small compartments for meat and for things they need to keep frozen on a long-term basis. And they were going to take some of it over there to store. Many of the folks over there, they do have refrigerators and freezers with them that are powered by propane. So they do have home refrigerators and a small freezer, but for long-term storage, they rent out a small facility if they're not going to can it.
Yeah, and now this, and obviously they use this for apple ciders and apple vinegars and
mm-hmm,
things
mm-hmm.
of the like, correct?
Yes, and we had some early pears that they blended a little apple and pear together and squeezed some of that out. It was pretty good.
That's very cool. I mean, this is 150 years old. I mean, I'm always amazed at homesteaders that get this old equipment, and because it's not as easy to maintain this stuff as it would look. And so, I remember seeing the pictures, and this press seemed in remarkably good shape.
It is. It's you can tell it's old, but it's been well used but well maintained, I guess is a good way to put it. And I agree with you. It's just a joy to see something that old is still in use. I'm not sure that we hardly make anything these days that would last 150 years, let alone be in usable condition at that time.
Right, and I think that's the thing that's interesting. I mean, it's nothing that you can buy nowadays will last as long as that stuff does, and the people who have that stuff, they're heirlooms. They hold on to them forever.
And yes, so it's just don't see them in the market.
Yeah, very, very much. That's quite true.
Now, I have one last question. We're running out of time here. We're going to have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Do you hunt and trap? I know, because I remember reading an article that you had out there for creating live traps.
Yes.
Are you a hunter-trapper?
Yes, I am. The trapping I'm hoping to really get back into a little more once I retire here next year. It's a little time-consuming for what I've got available now job-wise, but I do hunt, try to kill a deer or two every year, and the hunting season are just now starting to come in out here in Indiana. The squirrel season's opened up, and dove season will be next, and early goose season, so things are starting to happen for hunters out here, and everybody's getting geared up for that.
Well, because if I remember, you're a conservation officer, right? Do you work for, like, the local DNR? I don't remember where you work.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And I was, I'm always amazed. I was chatting with another conservation officer not that long ago, and
great.
he doesn't hunt, or he fishes. He's a fisherman, but he's not a hunter.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I remember seeing your article on live traps, and I knew I wanted to ask, and it was just kind of like, you know, I wonder how often in that you run into a conservation officer that doesn't actually hunt himself, maybe just fishes, or doesn't have time to do either. And
yeah.
So I was wondering how big of a part of your lifestyle that is.
Personally, it's a big part. I've tried to pass it on to my sons. I've got a grandson coming up. I'll be trying to do that with him. But I know that my son is also going to be doing that. But we all enjoy hunting, and our spouses are good about cooking up wild game and eating it. You know, some folks seem to have this aversion to wild game, whether they've tasted it or not, or maybe they've had a bad experience eating wild game and they're a little shy of it, but it's good, healthful food and can be fixed in just countless tasty ways. it's a good source of meat for all Americans.
I agree. So can I ask, I would like to ask your personal opinion on something. My daughter has shown interest in learning how to trap. And my brother-in-law wants to teach his son. And so the reason I went to your article is I remember having seen an article on traps, and I looked at it. As a conservation officer and as a person who's trapped and hunted in the past, are you more pro trapping with live traps and then dispatching the animal at that time, or do you prefer the traps that go ahead and are lethal for most of the animals at the time of capture?
Well, I'll lean towards the B, and let me explain. The live trap article that you refer to was one I wrote for Backwoods Home a while back, and it was written, you know, normally gardeners, you know, the folks around the farmstead, the homestead, may have a rabbit eating the green beans or a raccoon that's eating the cat's food on the back porch or something like that, and just have a need to move an animal. They don't have to be killed. They just need to be moved. And a live trap can certainly do that. And that's what they're mainly used for, or what I recommended that be used for in those articles, or in that article, rather. So for catching animals for fur, there again, that's something there. It depends on the animal. And some animals are best caught using a killer trap, a lethal trap like a conibear. Others can just about only be caught with a leg hold or a foothold trap. And the designs of those now are such as they lessen the physical impact on the target animal. They're padded jaws and made so to minimize the impact on the animal simply until we can check our traps and then kill the animal and use its fur. Other animals, I'm on those, on a foothold trap, coyotes, foxes, if you're in areas where you can trap bobcats and that kind of thing, they would certainly be the best. Animals such as muskrat, beaver, even mink, they can be caught in killer traps like conibears, conibear 110s and 220s and 330s, and or even with beaver, I've used drowning sets where, well, muskrats too. Muskrat and beaver use a drowning set where you may catch them in a leg hold trap, but then they instinctively go for deep water and then they end up drowning, which keeps them from twisting off in the trap. Sounds cruel, but it's just a more humane way of capturing the animal.
No, and I agree. It's just I've gone through and we've been looking at this and doing the research, and it's seeing some of the live traps, and that's why I was curious. I mean, I've seen both types of traps, and I just interesting from your perspective what you thought.
I would if you have an interest in it, I would check. You could probably Google it, check your local. I'm not even sure what state you fellows live in, but your local fish and wildlife agencies, such as our Indiana Department of Natural Resources, we offer trapper education classes, and your state agency may do the same thing. And there's an organization called the Fur Takers of America. They're located nationwide, and they probably have some educational programs as well.
Oh, that's very good, very good. Fur Takers of America. I'll look that up and I'll post it up on our website. I appreciate that. I mean, I think it's good for people. And my attitude at this point is if the kids are interested, strike while they're still interested, because as they get older, there's other things they're competing with to get them into it.
Amen. And there's a lot of food can be taken from trapping as well. I've eaten raccoon, I've eaten muskrat, I've eaten beaver, and it's another source of wild meat in some cases. So that's not to be discounted either, in addition to the use of the fur.
Yeah, I've definitely eaten raccoon, but I've never even thought of eating muskrat. I can't even imagine what that would taste like.
I don't like to eat an animal that, if it's in a killer trap, I try not to use those. But if it's still alive in a trap, if I happen to run it just right after it's caught, I don't mind killing it and then using it that way. I like to see something kicking it alive before I eat it.
No, I don't disagree with you. All right. Well, we have to get... Go ahead, sir.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your statement. I was just going to say that
some of the stuff I've cooked has been accused of being roadkill before, but that's not really true.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the stuff I've cooked too also probably tastes like roadkill, so I think we're probably all in the same thing. All right, well, we have to go. Thank you very much for being on the show again.
It's my pleasure.
Now, do you have any articles coming up in Backwoods Home?
I did do a short piece on making a cold frame using some PVC pipe and some treated lumber and some plastic material, and that should be coming out one of these days soon. Otherwise, I think that's about it for right now. I enjoy working with Backwoods Home. It's a really great publication, and I'm proud to be associated with them. They've printed probably 45 of my articles over the years, so they've been real good to me.
And your book is The Self-Reliant Homestead, and
yes,
that can be purchased either from Backwoods Home or from, I believe I got mine from Amazon.com.
If someone would be so desperate as to want a personalized copy, I have the address on my blog there that they can contact me, and I'd be happy to do that as well.
Wonderful. And then your blog is www.selfrelianthomestead.blogspot.com. Got it right that time.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, well, we've been talking live with Charles Sanders, and we thank you for coming on, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again here. Maybe when hunting season comes in and we got something in the traps, we can chat a little bit more with you about hunting and trapping.
That would be great. Let me know how it goes with your daughter learning.
All right. Thank you very much. Guys, we're going to go ahead and go to commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Colorado Ron and get it all wrapped up. So we'll be back after this commercial break.
Thank you, fellas.
You're listening to the Preparedness Radio Network. We'll be back after a word from our sponsor. Did you know that there were more natural disasters in 2011 than any other year in recorded history? So far, 2012 is on track to beat this record with even more earthquakes, tornadoes, and floods. When disasters and hyperinflation happens, grocery store shelves go empty. People are left without food and are forced to rely on the government. Don't let this happen to you. BuyEmergencyFoods.com offers delicious, ready-made meals from Legacy Premium Food Storage at the best prices available anywhere. Don't be fooled by the more expensive, less convenient, and poorly packaged emergency food storage options out there. Legacy Premium Food Storage meals are vegetarian friendly, taste delicious, and are ready to eat in just minutes. With premium ingredients made in the USA, plus all of these great tasting emergency meals come with a worry-free 25-year shelf life. So if you're worried about food inflation, economic crisis, unemployment, or natural disasters, then don't delay and prepare your family now. Order today and use the promo code E2E and get free shipping and 5% off on every item. Again, go to buyemergencyfoods.com and get prepared today. Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items, supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation. Order today and use the promo code E2E for an additional 5% off your order. Thanks for listening to a word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show on the Preparedness Radio Network.
Hey, you're back with Backlit Tome Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. So, Colorado, let's go ahead and wrap this segment up. Let's talk about homestead hunters. How's everything going with that? You got any new things for us to look at this week?
Yeah, I actually do. The one I wanted to talk about, you know, we touched on it a little bit last week, was the school buildings. That were for sale, and a lot of people had asked me where did I find, how did I do that? And basically I did a search for school houses or school buildings for sale. Now the obviously last week I mentioned like Detroit had a large number of schools, and I believe they had over 80 buildings that were for sale. And so I started researching those in all of my spare time, and I found a couple of them that were pretty good. It just depends on really what your needs are, what your wants are, but some of these school buildings were so old. I mean, they're like in the 1890s, and they were the smaller buildings, so that they were totally feasible, and they were on like 3 acres. So it was very interesting because, you know, with 3 acres and you know 30,000 square foot, 20,000 square foot building, I mean that's a lot of room to grow or do what you want to do. So anyway, I found that interesting. So The best thing to do on that, again, is I did a search. Basically, I put in their school building for sale in Google, and if you're interested in Detroit specifically, since I got a couple of emails on that one, just type in Detroit school building for sale, and the first 3 or 4 pop up are the links to those buildings that are for sale and PDF files, Word if you want to purchase it, and go through it that way. So what's interesting about those school buildings is, again, they have those big flat-top roofs, so you could do roof gardening if you wanted to, and save your 3 acres for other things.
Okay. So, I mean, so you're still, you haven't, you most of the ones that you found so far are in Detroit.
Yeah, most of them are in Detroit. The one that I found that wasn't in Detroit, I believe was, like, again, it was in your neck of the woods, and I believe it was in Iowa. Let me do a quick search here for it. But, the majority of them are in Detroit, Michigan. The one that was in Iowa, I believe, was, and here's the building for that one, and that's actually schoolbuildingforsale.com, and that was the one that was in Iowa, and they're obviously looking for somebody that can bring a possible business to that community if they can. And they're willing to negotiate on the price depending on what you're bringing to the table as far as employment or anything like that. But, you know, these are excellent if you think about them, because they have gymnasiums, they have, you know, some of them have auditoriums, they have a full kitchen, they have libraries, you know, all the classrooms can be converted into housing of some sort, whether it's living room or entertainment rooms or pool table rooms or whatever. I mean, there's just endless possibilities for a building that size, and you know as well as I do, there's just no way possible to even come close to building something for the amount of square footage that you're getting, cost-wise. So I mean, it's just no way possible. So, and again, most of these buildings, they are clear of asbestos.
Okay. All right. So, I'll take a look at this one, but what about your Costco deal? Were you able to make a purchase?
I did not. I hadn't. Honestly, I haven't messed with it this week. I've just been concentrating on. I was gearing up for my big trip, so in my spare time, I was packing and doing oil changes on the motorcycle, things like that. So I did not use my spare time doing anything with Costco this week. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just checking in. You know, we went and looked at it, and yeah, you know, we found that you had to have a business license, so we didn't actually take it any further than that at that point. But it's something that we're definitely going to try to see how we manage it and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the cost savings is so huge; it's worth getting a business license for it. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that can justify, you know, the $15 or $40 business license to offset the cost.
Right. It's just if you don't have a business, you'd have to go down and start a business in order to do it, because they make you bring your business license in. But, no, it still seems like as far as if it's something you can do in your area and you have the ability to get a business license, it definitely seems like an economical way to go ahead and increase your surplus of storage items.
Yeah, exactly. So the only other thing I've been working on this week was the new truck purchase. So that was the only addition, I guess. Like, I need more stuff to do, but yeah, I purchased a new truck this week, and I'm planning on building it out to be the ultimate one-stop shop truck to do it all.
So basically, you're replacing your Suburban.
Yeah, but less extreme. I'm not building up. I'm not going to do it that way. The truck will always look. For those that are unfamiliar with the truck, you can go to facebook.com/ Colorado Rod page, and I posted a picture up there. Anyway, it's a 77 F-250 crew cab four-wheel drive. Finding crew cabs are extremely difficult. Finding one that's a short bed and four-wheel drive is even harder. And so what I wanted to do is the reason I picked this truck is because it had a 4-speed in it. And the 4-speed is notorious as the MP435, and it's a very tough transmission. But it, more important, it also has a PTO attachment. So I can add a anything that can be PTO-driven. And one of the things that I've wanted to tackle, a project that has been eating at me for quite a while, is they make generators that you can attach to a PTO. And so my goal is to build a bracketry system and mount that generator actually under the floorboard of this truck and attach it to the PTO. Now, it's not going to be the most efficient generator, but it should be something I could use in an emergency to power the house.
Well, okay, so let's take a step back and explain to everybody what a PTO is. A PTO is a power takeoff unit. And, I mean, you see them a lot in tractors and things like that, in commercial vehicles, that people attach additional devices to. And in tractors, the PTOs are used to actually power everything from wood splitters to hay balers to everything else. And I believe it's just a drive shaft there. It connects everything to the drive shaft.
Well, yeah. The drive shaft is connected to the transmission. And it's a separate output. So you can actually have the vehicle running in neutral, and then you engage the PTO, and it turns this third drive shaft. So you have one drive shaft going to the back axle, one drive shaft going to the front axle, and then you have one drive shaft coming out of the PTO. So you put the truck in neutral, keep it running at idle. You put the truck in neutral, engage your PTO, and it will engage that third drive shaft. And again, it's a power takeoff unit, so you can have it run dang near anything that they've got wood splitters, they've got generators, they've got all kinds of accessories that you can mount to it. So I've had this big old Muncie PTO set up sitting in my garage for years. I've been itching to use, so I'm going to get it mounted on this thing and figure out what I can power off of it.
Now, I didn't realize that there were actually trucks that came with a PTO. So you're saying this 1977 F-250 actually had a PTO has a PTO system in it.
Yeah, well, the PTO is actually, the power takeoff unit is separate from the transmission, but this transmission has a plate on the side. You unbolt that plate and you can bolt this PTO system to the transmission so that you can actually add the PTO to it. Yes.
And it can remain on the truck full time, or is it something you need to disassemble? Wow.
Nope,
that's interesting.
Nope. You can stay on the truck full time, and you can, all you do is you just build a lever, you just build a lever and flip the lever, and it just engages the PTO, put the truck in neutral, and it's engaged. So there's a lot of things I can do with that PTO. Another thing I thought about doing, which I'm not sure I will, but one of the things I could do is put a dump bed on the truck and convert the truck bed to a dump bed so that and then you just have a hydraulic pump mounted to the PTO. You flip it on and raise the bed.
That's very cool. I didn't realize that you were going to be able to do that. But, yeah, having a PTO system is pretty cool. They're very handy if you have a small tractor. Matter of fact, if you're we're talking about homesteading earlier, if you decide to get a small farmstead and you pick up your first tractor, you always want to make sure that it's got a PTO system on there, because that's basically what runs all those extra implements that you're going to operate.
Yep, exactly. So, and I'll take detailed pictures of this and keep them posted on my Facebook page as I build this truck out. But my goal is to keep it stock looking, and all the accessories kind of under the skirt, so to speak.
Cool. And where'd you pick up the truck? Out of curiosity, how much did you end up paying for the truck?
I stole this truck. I got this truck for $3,000.
Wow. You did steal that. That's a pretty good price. Colorado Ron is pretty good at finding these deals for vehicles. But you're also handy enough to be able to work on them yourself.
Yeah, I do work on it myself. So this truck, again, the the add-ons that we want to do is obviously the PTO generator. I want to do an onboard air compressor. So I'm going to mount an air compressor under the hood so I can use power tools or air tools and, you know, be able to air up my own flat tires and, you know, things like that. You know, just having an onboard air compressor is just really handy. And the beautiful thing about these old trucks is they have so much room under the hood, I can do all kinds of stuff.
I was just thinking the same thing. I was just going to make the same comment, which is the thing I like about trucks 1980 or earlier is even if you had the largest engine that the manufacturer made for that time period, you still have enough room in there to do all the extra stuff. They're not like these engines nowadays where they take up every square inch of the engine space.
Absolutely. You know, and I was actually by a yard sale yesterday. I drove by a yard sale in the afternoon after I got back home, and something caught my eye, and this guy had several different solar panels sitting there, a bunch of different solar panels. And so I went over there and I asked him, and they were mosh-posh. None of them matched, and so it's not like I could put a whole new solar system on my roof. But anyway, I asked him, he said, you know, $50 and you can have all of them. And so I got, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 solar panels in different array, in different sizes and stuff. And one of them is an actual small one. It's about the size of a MacBook. And so I'm going to mount that one on the roof and use it to trickle charge. And I'm going to have a dual battery set up in this thing and keep the batteries fully charged with that trickle charge solar, keep them topped off.
And you're going to manage somehow to work this in between two events between now and October.
I didn't say it'd be done by the end of the year. I just have to start working.
At least it's a project that'll keep you at home instead of riding your motorcycle all over the place.
That's
That'll make Heather and the kids happy.
I told my wife I'm selling all the motorcycle stuff. I'm going to sell all the motorcycle stuff, and all that money is going towards this truck.
it looks like it's big enough for the kids to get riding it too and everything else.
Oh yeah, that's why I got it. It's to be able to do a crew cab like that, and it's crew cab dual bench seats, so I'll be able to. I can easily fit 6 adults in it if I needed to.
Nice. All right. Well, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool project to be working on. How are your quail and everything holding up?
The quail are doing good. Again, we're about 2 weeks out before they start laying eggs and that stuff. So we're pretty excited about that. And we have our rabbits are doing good. We're ready to start breeding them, and we're pretty excited about that as well. As a matter of fact, there's a couple more rabbits I'm thinking about grabbing. I found them on Craigslist, and they're about a half hour from me, and somebody claims that they have 10 of them, so I may give them a call today and go pick those up to help streamline and speed up the rabbit production.
You process your first set of rabbits because I can't wait to hear what the neighbors think when you're starting to butcher rabbits in your backyard.
How about you? How are your preps coming?
The chickens are doing well. I mean, the drought definitely hurt everything. So, prices of feed and everything else are all relatively high. I've been looking at information for dairy cows and dairy goats and, because that's something, milk prices are so high also that it's just, I think I want to go ahead and just get that taken care of. But I've got a fence and some property, and I'm just waiting until after the events are done. Because the problem is that when we take off for these events, we're gone for, 10 days. And
right.
It's not really fair to, So I think we're pretty much done with agricultural stuff until after the October event, and then I got hunting season, so I got to figure out. Hopefully, we can get some decent stuff in the freezer this year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah.
All right.
Just keep rocking on it. How's your food storage? Are you waiting on the
Costco? Haven't really done much. No. Well, I don't think we're going to wait too much longer on the Costco thing. I mean, we have to get down and look at and go to the auction down here because there's really not much. The store prices are so high and everything else. We want to go down and check out what the auction prices look like and see what we can get in bulk. I'm not too optimistic. I think I agree with Charles on this one, which this might be a year to really just go get a lot of canned goods and everything else when they're on sale, because it's almost going to cost more money to can than it is to just go buy the product.
Right. Nope, I agree. It's just, especially to get the jump start that you need. Because one bad season, and when you're first starting out, you have one bad season, you're back to ground zero. You've got nothing to fall back on. So it's important to have, several canned goods stocked up in the basement so that something does happen, you're good to go.
Yeah, I mean, again, it doesn't hurt. I mean, obviously, the best way to do it is if you can produce in your own garden and everything else. But part of being prepared is being prepared for times like this. This is why, it's funny. My brother-in-law was saying that my sister-in-law is done canning for the season. She's done X amount of quarts of this and X amount of quarts of that, and so she's basically done. And the more I've been looking at this, it's just kind of like you almost hate to not keep going because when you have a bad year like this year, you want to make sure you have enough to carry you through even more than that. So I don't know. It's a catch-22. It's time. It's how much time do you have and how far do you want to go? How deep do you want to make your pantry?
Right. Well, all we know is, with all these interviews that we've done and the people we've talked to, the only thing that we're pretty confident on is the food prices aren't going to get any cheaper.
I agree. All right, well, let's wrap this up. Next on PRN, we have 21st Century Homekeeping Radio, and that's with our friend Sylvia. I believe I think I saw a couple comments. I'm trying to finish up the scheduling today. I think Sylvia is one of the people that are going to be coming out to the North Carolina event, isn't that right?
That is correct. She'll be there.
Wow, I'm looking forward to meeting her and listening to what she has to say. So I got to give her a call this week. So like always, if you want to check out the website, www.backwoodshome.com, to find out more about our expo in Hickory or Mesa, Arizona for this year, www.selfreliancexpo.com. And you're always welcome to visit our Facebook pages. You can visit Colorado Ron at his new page, and his is, and you got to make sure you get it right, it's facebook.com/ Colorado Ron Page, all one word. Otherwise, it does not come up. You can also go to Backwoods Home Mag, Preparedness Radio, Self-Reliance Expo, or Bubba Da Vinci. Any of those will get you to the Facebook pages for us. And I think we're all grateful that Colorado Ron did not get hurt. And hopefully spend some time with your family. Glad that you're off the motorcycle. Just take it easy over the next couple of days.
Will do.
All right, guys, from Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci, thank you for listening to Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed. We'll see you next week.
Take care.
You've been listening to BHM Radio, the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine on the Preparedness Radio Network. Tune in every other week at this time to get more information on the articles you love. Questions or comments for the hosts? Email them at coloradoron@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives.
Want to reduce your dependence on the electrical grid? Trying to save money on groceries? Preparing for a major power outage? We can help. Layman's is your source for everything you need for heat, food, light, and water when there is no power. Glenda Lehman Irvin here for Lehman's in Kidron, Ohio. My father, Jay Lehman, founded our store in 1955 to serve the local Amish with non-electric appliances, tools, and houseware items. Today, through our website, laymans.com, a print catalog, and a retail store, we provide oil lamps, water pumps, wood stoves, canning supplies, and hand tools to customers all over the world. If you think it isn't made anymore, check with Lehman's before you give up. Visit laymans.com or call us at 1-877-438-5346 for a free catalog, or just stop by. We're located about an hour south of Cleveland.
Discover the taste of the sun. Thousands of preppers have acquired a sun oven to have on hand in the event of an emergency and have been pleasantly surprised by the improved taste of sun-cooked foods. Sun ovens are a preparedness item you can start using today. A sun oven will pay for itself by reducing your utility bills and by keeping your house cooler in the summer. Food can be baked, boiled, or steamed at temperatures of 360 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit with the power of the sun. Sun ovens are often confused with homemade solar cookers, but they get considerably hotter, cook food faster, and hold temperatures longer. Sun ovens fold up in seconds, carry like a suitcase, and have many innovative features which make them the ultimate solar appliance. For the past 25 years, sun ovens have been proudly made in the U.S. They are durable and have a long life and come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. For a discount coupon, email preppers at sunoven.com. That's preppers at sunoven.com.
I'm Dr. Prepper, and I'm here today to tell you about the Wonder Mill. Their patented grain mills create the most luxurious and quality flours from any hard grains or beans. They contract with the world's best suited factories to manufacture the Wonder Mill to the highest specifications in the industry that they plan and design right up there in Pocatello, Idaho. They are the only American company with both electric and hand-operated models. I like them so much, I bought both, and you should too. I use the electric model for the finest flour, and I use the hand-operated model for making my grits and creamy wheat for breakfast. And I can have it fresh every day. With the Wonder Mill's lifetime warranty and the fact that these are simply the world's fastest, quietest, cleanest operating grain mills, it's no wonder that most preparedness and kitchen professionals prefer the Wonder Mill over all the other grain mills on the market. I love both mine. I know you'll love yours too. Go to thewondermill.com. That's thewondermill.com and Wonder Mill Grain Grinders. Get yours today. Tell them that Dr. Prepper sent you, will you?
You've been listening to the Preparedness Radio Network, offering helpful and timely tips on preparing for natural and man-made disasters. Timely and useful tips on gardening and homesteading. Check us out online at BePreparedRadio.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.